Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your hosts, Frank
and Matt
Allen.
And with that, we're back with Fight Night Picks. Can't wait for this weekend's card. Holy smokes, a bantamweight Rob Font taking on Cody Garbrandt in the main event. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, your right, as always, the other half of our hosting duo, Matt Allen. You can find him on the respective socials at Matt Allen FNP. And now, Matt, we gotta say, I mean, there's a reason I'm wearing the baseball jersey. We're a baseball show now. I mean, straight up, it was a rough start to the prelims last weekend. If you didn't get the chance to check it out, FNP Recaps with Matt and John, the episode just released. It was a rough start to the card, but it ended up kind of turning around. We had the fight companion on the weekend. We both went 4-1 on the main card. But all that's just fluff because we have a big-time card coming up this weekend. We're really looking to right the ship, and I can't wait for this card, Matt, because there's a lot of under-the-radar matchups.
Yeah, it's a really fun fight card. Now, yes, this doesn't have the glitz and the glamour of some of the pay-per-views that we have had recently, but, like, Rob Font versus Cody Garbrandt at the top of the fight card is going to be a very, very fun matchup, and they're just going up and down through the card. Like, Yan Xiaonan and Carlos Esparza, I don't think people realize how important that fight is for that division because people thought Carlos Esparza was supposed to get the title shot instead of Rose Namajunas, who ended up winning the title. So that just tells you how close both those women are to eventually getting that title shot. And I do think this card top to bottom should be a really exciting one.
Really looking forward to it. And Matt, we'll flip it on over to our Fight of the Night screen, as always presented by Manscaped. And when we're talking about possible Fight of the Nights, we really have to highlight some of the lower weight classes this weekend. Matt, we have Czech Republic's David Dvorak taking on Brazil's Haulian Paiva. Absolutely love the fight. This definitely has fireworks written all over it.
Such a fun fight down at flyweight between two guys who can really get it done everywhere. I mean, Paiva so great on the feet. Dvorak really, really well rounded. Such a great fight down there at flyweight in a division that kind of is wide open. So any 2-3-4 fight win streak really can get you right up to the top of the division.
And focusing in on a second pick for Fight of the Night, how can you not go with your main event? Rob Font, heavy-handed, great boxing, taking on No Love Cody Garbrandt, the former champ. He came back last year, had an absolutely stunning knockout over Rafael Assuncao, but he's been out for a really long time since COVID, long hauler. He's had all of these issues, and now he's going to be taking on the ever dangerous Font. The New England Cartel still looking to take over. I love this fight.
This is such a fun fight at bantamweight because with Cody Garbrandt, you not only have the former champion, but you still have a fighter that a lot of people believe is the best fighter in this weight division. Now, I understand he has lost a few fights in a row, but Cody Garbrandt on any given day can beat anybody at bantamweight. Now, yes, his whole maybe move to flyweight was a little bit weird at the time, but this is a really, really fun fight against Rob Font. And stylistically, this is going to be an absolute banger of a matchup because Rob Font loves to box, and that's what Cody Garbrandt's known as. So again, I could not be more excited for this movie.
Absolutely love the slate of fights that we have coming up this weekend. Make sure you check out our presenting sponsor, Manscaped, at manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're gonna get 20% off and free shipping. Matt, love the fights this weekend. As we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend in the lightweight division. We have Russia's Demir Ismagulov taking on Brazil's The Turn, Rafael Alves. And Matt, well, Rafael Alves' nickname sounds like some show that you'd find on Netflix. This guy can definitely bring it in the octagon. We're expecting his debut to be a little bit of a short notice affair down at featherweight, taking on Pat Sabatini. And Matt, we've seen some bad weight cuts, and listen, we've got another fighter on this card that recently tried to set a little bit of a record in her own record, Norma Dumont, but for Rafael Alves, weighed in at 157.5 for a fight at featherweight. We talked about it in the original breakdown. This guy used to fight at lightweight, his fight on Contender Series to come into the UFC, that was at featherweight. Weight could be an issue because he's a heavily muscled guy at 155, very explosive striker, very unorthodox striker, and a really tricky grappler as well for Rafael Alves. The things that you like, he's coming out of MMA Masters. We've seen good fighters there, less Mike Perry, but more Miguel Baeza, Danny Chavez, Colby Covington.
Jacare?
No, not Jacare. But we have seen some really good fighters out of MMA Masters recently. And for Alves, again, a champion on the regional scene. He was with Titan FC. He was on an episode of Dana White's looking for a fight. He kind of gets the call. And in the episode, Dana goes, you know, I don't normally sign a guy that's 30 or around 30. And I don't normally sign a guy with this much experience. But We'll give him a go. We'll put him on the show. And he's had long layoffs and breaks throughout his career. So his third to last fight, 2 years, 10 months ago against Bibit Nazarov. Really good win there. Then he takes off quite a bit of time. 2 years ago was his fight against Felipe Douglas. And then after that, 8 months and a week ago over Alejandro Flores. You like what you see out of Alves on the regional scene?
I do, because at face value, there's a lot to like from Rafael Alves. He's got decent jiu-jitsu. I'm going to get more into that in a second, though. And his striking's not bad for a guy who does have a decent ground game. The few things that I really dislike about Alves are, well, A, the cardio, and the fact that, you know what's not a great stat? Winning 7 fights by submission is a great thing to have. You know what's not great to pair with all those wins by submission? 6 losses by submission as well. And for Alves, he is really one of those kill or be killed fighters. And I don't say that in a way that, oh, he's going to go out there and get knocked out just by getting into these wild exchanges. He's going to fight until the point of exhaustion. Now, the issue is that that point of exhaustion for him will get him submitted. Of course, Rodolfo Vieira, I think we've kind of been famously kicked from his bandwagon, but he's one of those guys who, if he is 100% clear of mind in a jiu-jitsu setting, let's say, where there is no ground to pound and he won't get extremely tired, he's probably not going to get tapped out by most MMA fighters. I feel very comfortable saying that. But once you add in the hits to the head, once you add in the wrestling and just the overall cardio involved in MMA, that's when you can see sort of cracks in even grapplers like Rodolfo Vieira's armor. With Rafael Alves, he is great on the ground, but I do really concern when he gets into those long grappling exchanges with his opponents. Yes, he might win them in that first round, and he might win a few in the second, but as that fight progresses, I'm always going to worry about a fighter like him in that third round.
Well, his opponent, Demir Ismagulov, is somebody that we haven't seen in some time, and this is a guy that, listen, when Fight Night Picks began 2018, I was watching the M1 Globals, I was watching ACB, I was really trying to get the dirt and the tape on some of these champions from outside of the major organizations in North America to really get a little well-rounded. Demir Ismagulov was a guy that really popped up on my radar, and Kazakhstan has seen their fair share of fighters in the UFC even recently. Shavkat Rakhmonov, you think Maria Agapova, and so on and so forth. But with Demir Ismagulov, former M1 Global champ, he's a master of sport in army hand-to-hand combat. You don't see that very often. And you look at the way that this guy fights. Plenty of finishes out of his overall, 12 of 22 by knockout. And you look at the way that he's won fights in the UFC. And I think this is a really telling stat, because you look at the first fight, Alex Gorgeous. Okay, he was a little early, and we haven't seen him in the UFC since. Joel Alvarez absolutely dominated him. And Thiago Moises, who, listen, Moises continued fighting. Now he has a big fight against Islam Makhachev coming up. But that fight against Moises was 1 year and 8 months ago. I'm going to read you off a couple of numbers, and you probably didn't think about this, but for the 3 fights that we've had Demir Ismagulov, so 3 fights, all to a decision, and the judges' scorecards were, there were 5-30-27s, 3-30-26s, 1-30-25 out of all of his fights. He's absolutely dominated the competition. Very, very heavy. He's a great striker. I love everything I've seen out of Demir Ismagulov, and he's one of those guys, dark horse in the division. It's just a shame that we haven't seen him compete in so long.
I couldn't agree more, because when I think about guys like Demir Ismagulov and guys like Thiago Moises, those are guys outside the top 15, and there's other fighters out there too, but there's guys outside the top 15 who just can't get fights with guys inside the top 15, or even guys with decent names, and it's just unfortunate, because anyone who has a name isn't going to want to give some young up-and-comer the opportunity to really make their own name off of the legacy, if you will, of that fighter. But for Demir, if you beat a guy like Thiago Moises, you should only be like, okay, there's only top 20 guys and top 15 guys in your future. So it is really unfortunate that we haven't been able to see him compete for 20 months, but this is a great tune-up fight for him. And it's unfortunate to say that, but you look at Alves. Yes, he belongs to 155. I do think the whole 145 experiment, just kind of dumb, because it was basically like when Rogerio Bontorin fought Matt Schnell. If Matt Schnell had weighed in at 125 and then Bontorin had showed up at like 137, then that fight would have been ridiculous. And that's basically what Alves did. I think this is one of those fights where it's like, hey, you messed up in your last one. We're going to give you a stylistic nightmare. Because for Alves, I think he can hang on the feet with Demir for a little bit of this fight. And I think he can hang with some of the wrestling and some of the grappling exchanges. But my problem is that when you're fighting a guy who can fight not only with a high work rate, but just make you work during the fight, I just think it's a really bad matchup for Alves at the end of the day.
We'll have to see how it plays out. And again, the whole cardio thing, you know, if you want to go back and have a little bit of fun, go back and watch our video, Christos Iago, Sean Soriano. Now, if you do look into the comments section, one of Christos's coaches hopped in there and said, boys, he doesn't have to invest in a Peloton. His third round cardio is not all that great, but he likes to finish guys quick. And hey, credit where credit's due. Great win by Yagos. You guys trained him the right way.
That was awesome.
What the hell do these guys on the internet know? But if you look at it for Alves, he has tended to tire in his fights, and there's certain points where he either gets caught or he gets guys in really good defensive submissions. He can get them in, you know, it could be a D'Arce, it could be a guillotine, whatever it is. Alves is a master of it. Almost think like an Andrea Muniz in a little bit of a way. Now, I don't know if he's
settled down a lot, though.
I don't know if he's going to be breaking arms. The other thing that he does, really, really creative striker. We've got Chris Barnett making his UFC debut this week as well. Insane heavyweight with some of the things that he does. But I remember if you watch Alves' fight on Dana White's Contender Series, it's one of those things, I bet you Paul Felder would complain about it. He's the type to do like flips before the fight. Buddy, you're not Carl Edwards. Don't do the flips. You're just expending that tank even more, but I digress. If we have a look at the odds, Matt, Demir Ismagulov, the biggest favorite on the card, open to minus 500. He's minus 581 right now. For Alves, open to plus 335. He's now plus 414. And if we have a look at the total Tapology votes, 968 votes. 94% Ismagulov, 82% by decision. The odds heavily favor Ismagulov, last point from me. And listen, the fans, I'm on Tapology. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there in the comments section that will as well. And please let us know who you're picking in this one. I like Ismagulov. The only thing that worries me is Alves is a master defensive submission. And he's a really, really explosive striker. But if you can withstand the first round, it's Ismagulov's fight.
That's the problem. When you are that really explosive striker, there is a give and take with having all that power. And normally the takeaway is having a poor gas tank. And I know we fed this horse quite a bit with Alves, but it is such a big part of his game that, yes, he brings that big storm in the first round. But if you can weather it, and Ismagulov, he can go to the wrestling. He can outstrike Alves, especially from the outside. I just think stylistically, everything is going to be a really hard matchup for Alves. Now, with the time off, maybe it will take about a round for Demir to kind of get his feet under him and look like the Demir Ismagulov of old. But I do think stylistically, this is a really hard one for Rafael Alves.
Both of us going with Kazakhstan's Demir Ismagulov to get the win. Can't wait for the fight. Lightweight is absolutely on fire with a new champ, Charles Oliveira, at the top. We got a great card coming up this weekend. Rob Font taking on Cody Garbrandt in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Absolutely love our next fight at lightweight. We have Demir Hadzevic, the Bosnian Bomber, taking on Yancy Medeiros, crowd favorite, five-time bonus winner with the UFC. 75 G's, baby! That's what they're saying these days. Now, I don't know if that's going to extend to fight nights. I don't know if it was because everything's bigger in Texas, but Vegas has to get ready for this fight, which was originally scheduled between Hadzevic and Nicolas Mata. And while I would have loved that fight, in steps Yancy Medeiros on short notice. You know exactly what you're going to get out of him. It's either going to be one of the wildest fights you've ever seen or way too much camaraderie with Donald Cerrone and his grandmother in a really, really odd one. But overall, Yancy Medeiros, very well-rounded. Fought a middleweight once with Strikeforce, which is crazy. And I think that thick boy picture is a sure dog picture. But coming into this one, on a little bit of a salty run, if you really look into the five on in, it's not great. He's lost his last three to Cowboy Cerrone, Gregor Gillespie, and Lando Venata. And if you look at it for Demir Hadzevic, same deal. 2-3. You look at the losses. Alain Patrick over 3 years ago. He beats Nick Hine by split. He beats Polo Reyes. Yikes. He loses to Christos Yagos. You lose to Renato Moicano. The only thing that bugs me out of all of those, like, you think of Demir Hadzevic in your mind. You look at the picture that we have over there, and he's kind of like hunched stiff over. But when you watch Demir Hadzevic fight, he's got that really high tie stance. He throws really good kicks. He's good boxing. He's good in and out. He struggles a little bit with the ground game sometimes. And we saw that in the fight against Moicano where it was like, okay, we're going to box. And then Moicano gets him in a body lock, trips him, takes him down. Moicano's in his guard and he's like, I don't really like this anymore. So Moicano just stands up. Hadzevic lazily stands back up, and what does Moicano do? Inserts himself behind his back, pulls him down, and chokes him out. And then they had a weird exchange after that, because they're not friends. But in a fight like this for Demir Hadzevic, he's out of Arte Suave now. He's working with, I don't know, Kenneth Berg. When's he ever coming to the UFC? 2020 was the year Kenneth Berg rumors, and Panny Kianzad also there. It's an interesting fight for Hadzevic going from Mata to now Yancy Medeiros, who's back in Hawaii, training with Max Holloway at Gracie Technics in Honolulu.
This is a fight to figure out who's going to Bellator. And I hate that I have to say that, but let's be honest. I do think the loser of this is probably going to get cut. Because for Demir Hadzevic, like, you've had your opportunities. You fought Renato Moicano, who had so much hype down at 145. And let's be honest, Renato Moicano has never really been what we were promised. Like, he's a good fighter, but his best win is definitely the win over Cub Swanson, and a win over Cub Swanson. The win over Calvin Kattar was nice, but it's very early in Kattar's career. Now, I would say, yes, you got me there. Calvin Kattar is the better win. But when you look back, the biggest win of his career, especially at the time, was the Cub Swanson win. And then you look at Moicano up at lightweight. Okay, listen, getting knocked out by Fiziev, that's going to happen. It's going to happen to a lot of guys, and I'm assuming it's going to happen to a lot of ranked guys sooner rather than later. But still, he just looks so flat in that performance that when you lose to Renato Moicano at lightweight, I have a lot of questions about you fighting other lankier guys at that weight class. And it's not like Yancy Medeiros shares many similarities with Renato Moicano. I mean, build-wise, they're both kind of tall and thin. The thing I'm worried about in this fight, it's kind of the same thing we talked about after the Yancy Medeiros-Lando Venata fight. You can get that great version of Yancy Medeiros where it's, oh, I'm going to flick the jab out there, I'm going to get cracked, I'm going to get into one of these crazy wars. Or you're going to get the version of Yancy Medeiros who's a little bit tentative, because he does realize that, like, those wars start to cause a toll on you. And I just don't think Yancy Medeiros has the same level of durability that he did earlier on in his UFC career. It's nothing against Yancy Medeiros. It's just, you can't have crazy fights with Cowboy, the Brazilian or the American version, and the likes in the lightweight division, and then just expect to continue to be able to have fights like that in his career. And this is a guy you have to remember, he fought at lightweight all the way back when Dustin Poirier was first on his run at lightweight. Now, Medeiros missed weight all the way back then. It's always something that I think about when I think about Yancy Medeiros, because after he fought Eric Silva, he said, hey, I'm probably never going to go back down to lightweight. Like, this is a really big win for me at welterweight, but that's my problem. He had a big win over Eric Silva at welterweight. It's been a while since Eric Silva was a big win at welterweight. I understand that was UFC 212. It was like Hawaii versus Brazil with Max Holloway fighting Jose Aldo at the top of the card. But my problem with Yancy Medeiros is I feel like we let the excitement of his fights get in the way of his skill set. With Yancy Medeiros, I think he's a decent fighter, and I think he would be considered a decent volume striker. But with Medeiros, he's not the most durable guy in the world. So if he is in those extended exchanges on the feet, I'm always worried he's going to get clipped, and especially at 155 with him cutting so much weight. I don't know, I'm just worried about the overall durability of Medeiros staying at 155, and that's not a concern I have about Hadzovic.
I mean, Medeiros, like you said, much longer fighter. He's much taller, much longer in terms of the reach. You like to see that out of him, especially in the fights that, again, Medeiros is used to winning. You talked about it. Eric Silva, that's his fifth to last fight, and that was almost 4 years ago.
And that was an early stoppage, too, for what it's worth. If you're getting early stoppage wins over Eric Silva,
it's kind of tricky. If you look at the line for Medeiros, he opened a minus 125. He's a minus 105 right now, so some money's come in on Hadzovic. He opened a plus 105. He's at a minus 118 right now. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, a little bit of a surprise. 981 total votes, 73% Medeiros, 71% by decision. And throughout most of the video, while your mouth moved quicker than your brain did, and we really talked about this one between Medeiros and Hadzovic, you look at it, and it is a tricky one because Medeiros training mostly is jiu-jitsu. It seems like he's going to work that into his game. He does have the striking available to him. For Demir Hadzovic, you look at some of the wins so far in the UFC, and again, he is also the older fighter, which is kind of tricky, less pro fights, but you look at the wins that he's had in the UFC. Martian Held, that was a crazy one. I mean, look at him now. Look at us. Crazy win with the PFL over Natan Schult. But Nick Hine, the Sergeant, and then Polo Reyes, a little tricky. Mirbek Taisumov, people are going to lose to him. And now that he just got his U.S. visa, I think a lot more people are going to be losing to him. But it is a really tricky one for me to try and pick. It is a very, very close line. So what are you thinking here?
I like Demir Hadzovic in this fight. I do, because if this fight is primarily going to be contested on the feet, which I do believe it is, at least he has some level of durability on the feet. Listen, Hadzovic is a guy who's been finished in the past too, but he's been able to get hit clean on the chin and still walk forward because of it. With Yancy Medeiros, it is one of those cases of when he does get hit, he tends to get rocked at this stage of his career. So I do ever so slightly have to side with Demir Hadzovic. It's not that I'm the most confident in this pick, and I do think this could be one of those underrated fight of the nights if it does turn into kind of the best version of what we're hoping it to be. But at the end of the day, I do have to take Hadzovic.
I mean, listen, Yancy Medeiros the last 3 years has kind of been like the Great Pumpkin. I mean, one fight, all of them losses. Is this the time that he comes out, Linus gets the blanket, and we all get a win? I don't know. And I am ever so slightly going with Demir Hadzovic as well. Bosnian Herzegovina with the win. I have a really tough time, so if you can make a good argument below for either fighter, I'm definitely willing to listen to it. as well as on question mark kicks on Saturday. But it is a really tricky fight. You got the performance bonus machine, and Yancy Medeiros taking it on short notice. You've got Hadzovic, who we both have in this fight, Matt. Can't wait for this one. Great fights in the lower weight classes and some interesting ones in some upper weight classes. Ooh. We have a great card coming up this weekend. Not going to want to miss any of it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Featherweight banger coming up this weekend. I certainly expect a finish. We have Kuya Josh Kulibao welcoming China's Xia Yilan, the Wolverine, to the octagon. For Xia Yilan, a guy coming in out of China, UFC Performance Institute in Shanghai. And unfortunately for him, his teammates didn't really have a great time out just a number of cards ago, UFC 261. Put on impressive performances for the most part. And for Xia Yilan, looking to kind of recapture some of that thunder under Dean Amazinger over there with the PI. And listen, this guy has had an absolute roller coaster ride of a time making it to the UFC. He had 6 fights last year, went 5-1. He has a win over Alexei Olenek from last year. But not that Alexei Olenek, of course. And this is a guy that spent some time at featherweight quite a while ago, most of his time at lightweight. So it'll be interesting to see the weight cut for him, especially coming over to the States, acclimatizing, getting ready for the fight. But an absolute joy to watch fight. And I mean, this was one of those things, and if you're trying to do tape study for this fight, take it from me. What you're going to want to do, go to Tapology, find the characters up close to his English spelling of his name, pop those over to Google and check out some websites you probably never seen before if you're an English speaker. But I had a joy watching his fights. If you go back through, you can see those 6 that he had last year. And the one that I want to highlight, the loss to Rong Zhu at WLF Force 47. Not that long ago, back in September of last year. After that, picks up a couple of wins with JCK, whose production values are really second to none. And I'm not getting paid to say that. I actually really did enjoy watching his fights. I have a full page of notes on this one, Matt, because again, it was a lot of fun going back. But if you look at it for Xia Yilan, if he's going to have a lot of success striking, a lot of good blitzes, he can throw a pretty good right hand. But typically, he's going to want to rinse and repeat with the takedowns, take his opponent down, gain position, hammer away at them. He's taking on a really interesting guy in Joshua Kulibao, almost 27 years old. And his 2 UFC fights, absolute polar opposites.
They really have been. For Kulibao, I don't know if I'm going to lump him into that category of anytime he fights, he could get a performance bonus because, hey, it just could happen. Or it could just be a dud. But I am a firm believer that there is a good fighter in Josh Kulibao who can work his way up the ranks. Because here's the thing. You can't have a split decision that, and I'm not throwing you under the bus, but that you thought he won. And that a lot of other people who I would say I respect in the MMA media world thought that he beat Charles Jourdain. Charles Jourdain is like the hotness all of a sudden. Now, he's not the biggest deal in the UFC, but having a close fight with a guy like that at least proves that you belong in the UFC. And we talk about this a lot. You can lose fights and you can win fights, and sometimes you can win a fight but still not really gain much stock by doing it. And sometimes you can lose a fight and gain a ton of stock. That was one of those fights where at the end of it, you were just like, hey, great job, both guys, because they both showed off every aspect of MMA. And that's the great thing I like about Kulibao. You mentioned it, almost 27 years of age, just coming into his prime right now, and he has a lot of skills that you really like out of a young up-and-coming striker. He's got great power from both sides. He's got great overhands. Now, the one thing I'm not a huge fan about with Kulibao is he can get overwhelmed with volume. When you look in the Jourdain fight, when Jourdain was having success, I'm always going to think about Aljamain Sterling fighting Petr Yan when I think about this, but remember on the feet when Sterling was having success, he would just kind of paw at Yan, make Yan put his hands up. Kulibao can kind of get in those defensive shields sometimes, and I'm not saying that Xia Liang is going to be the guy who's going to go out there and, you know, throw a ton of volume on him like he's Max Holloway and then shoot for a double leg, but it is a position that Kulibao can sometimes get caught in. But the one thing that Kulibao does have, and that he does rely on maybe a little bit too much, is he does have big power on the feet. And he's a guy who, if you are using that forward movement to try to crash into him using your takedown attempts or your volume, you've always got to be careful, because just one big counter shot by him, because he does have good power in both hands, one big power shot can put pretty much anyone's lights out. And that's why this is a great litmus test for Xia Liang in this fight.
In this fight, we look at it for Josh Kulibao. Yeah, going back, watching that fight against Charles Jourdain, first round Kulibao, no deal. Dropped him in the first round. One of the judges scored that round for Charles Jourdain. How crazy is that? Because judging doesn't make any sense.
Was that in Texas?
I don't know. It didn't make any sense at all. But yeah, Kulibao was able to drop him in the first. He beat him in the first regardless, but he dropped him as well. Second round, really, really close. If you scored it for Kulibao, I kind of did on the second or third viewing, then so be it. If you go to MMA Decisions, 14 had it 29-28 for Caulibau, and then you had three that had it 29-28, three had it Caulibau, 14 had it for Jourdain. The judges had it, yikes. There was a 10-9 for two with Caulibau in the first round, but again, one had it full across the board, 30-27 Jourdain. The point of it is, for Caulibau, really good striker. Like, something that we didn't get to see at all in his first fight. And listen, it's hard to look good against Jalen Turner on short notice when you're popping up a weight class. And Jalen Turner's a big guy for 55 anyway. A guy that I wish we got to see more often. But you look at the fight that he had in his last one out, and you can really tell that this is a guy out of Igor MMA in Australia, training with Jamie Mullerkey and a little bit of Alexander Volkanovski, and he's not doing the Ultimate Fighter or over in New Zealand. He's really got the tools. Again, when he's from Orthodox, he's going to try and box you. He might throw a few kicks. When he goes southpaw, he is only going to kick. And when he goes southpaw, he throws a kick high, I'd say, to the body. Usually ends up hitting the arms or to the head. Great kicks. Really explosive fighter, too. And I'm eager to see what we get of Caulibau this time. Because, again, for Shai Yilun, when he tries to get into some of those firefights, it just doesn't really work for him. The fight against Rong Zhu, it's like feeling out process. And then you see Rong Zhu just kind of step in a little bit, clip him with the right hand, drop him, and that's pretty much all she wrote. He followed up with it. If you go and you look at his last two fights, and I kind of want to highlight those because you got to get back on the horse after a loss like that. I still think Rong Zhu is a pretty good prospect, but the fight against Bahe Tian, who was 20-10 at the time, I honestly scored it, 30-25 on my card. I had it 10-9, round one, 10-8, 10-8. For Shai Yilun, because all he did was wrestle, and his opponent had zero defenses to it whatsoever. If you go and watch his last fight against Tan Zhao Wang, that's one where he just takes him down, his opponent kind of flops around a little bit, he gains position, he finishes him. He had his absolute way with that, gets him back flat at one point, ends up with a rear naked choke. So you can tell that the skills are there from Shai Yilun. You can tell how good Josh Caulibau is on the feet. Maybe we get a little bit of defensive wrestling out there. Those are some of the questions coming into the UFC. Where's the cardio at this point? But I do love this fight, and I think there's probably an opportunity for a finish here.
Oh, without a doubt. But for me, here's my issue. With Caulibau, it's almost better to lose to a guy like Jalen Turner and have a really close fight with a guy like Charles Jourdain than beating a guy 4 months ago who had a record of 3-5. And I understand everyone has guys like that on their record. But the fact that Shai Yilun has experience against that lower level competition just so recently, it doesn't give me a lot of confidence of, oh, now you beat a guy who's 3-5. Now you're ready for a really tough out in Caulibau in your UFC debut. So for me, I have to pick Caulibau, but I do think Shai Yilun could wrestle his way to a victory in this fight.
Yeah, it is a great fight. If you have a look at the odds, Caulibau open a -225 favorite. He's a -252 right now. If you look at it for China's Shai Yilun, he opened a +190. He's at about +202. Over on Tapology, 962 total votes, 82% Caulibau, 71% by decision. For the 18% that have Shai Yilun, 48% by decision. So the fans are thinking decision. I still do think there's a definite possibility for a finish here, but I do like Caulibau based on the striking prowess that we've seen prior. Shai Yilun, good fighter. I just don't know if this is the matchup this time out. It should be a great one, but we both have Caulibau here.
Yes, we do.
Both of us going with Australia's Kuya Joshua Caulibau to get the win. Can't wait for the fight. It should be absolute fireworks in our main event. Rob Font taking on Cody Garbrandt. You're not going to want to miss it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Interesting fight coming up this weekend at flyweight. We have a vicious pit bull. No, I'm just kidding, but one guy does train out of Pitbull Brothers gym. In vicious bulldog, Victor Rodriguez taking on Bruno Silva. Matt, it's a really interesting matchup. And again, if you're talking about fights where you expect to finish, this is probably going to be one of them. For Victor Rodriguez, we had a lot of fun breaking down his pro career up to his late call-up to the UFC. I want to throw it back. He took on Adrian Yanez. He got absolutely blown out of the water. But the original bit of preview still stands. We're going to throw it over to that, and then we'll whip it right on back. And for Victor Rodriguez, coming in on short notice out of AK-49 Fight Club up there in Alaska there, eh? You look at some of his fights. He's a purple belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. This guy's a southpaw. He throws 110% into every single strike. And if he doesn't finish you early, I'd worry about it. You go back and watch his last fight. He was taking on a really tough out in Jared Mazurek, who's 8-1 going into it. Finishes him in the second round.
Mazurek looked like a brick shithouse in that one. These guys slugged it out. I mean, Mazurek took him down early. Rodriguez got up, got a takedown of his own. Again, slugged it out. I can't emphasize this enough. The guy throws everything into his shots. And I mean, you look at his overall career record. He lost in 2014 to Jeff Bailey. It's solid as a rock FC. He lost to Johnny, we're going to ride those tauntauns, tauntaun, and got knocked out in the first round of that fight. But apart from that, a decent record. Again, the jiu-jitsu background, you can tell just off of a limited sample size if you go back and watch the Alaska FC fights that the guy is well-rounded. I will note, he wore sweatpants, a purple belt, and like work boots or like winter boots into his last fight, which is, I mean, it's par for the course in Alaska.
He dresses like James Harden.
It's Alaska. It's going to happen. This is such a mismatch. Like, it's such
an
odd deal of matchmaking.
So, Matt, Victor Rodriguez took that fight on 11 days' notice. He absolutely got rocked in one of the knockout of the year candidates, I want to say, against Yanez. And we know how good Yanez is. Going to be taking on Randy Costa at some point. The Dr. Pepper Reese's Pieces matchup will never die. But for Victor Rodriguez, now he gets a full camp. You're taking on Bruno Silva. Oh, wait, that's not the case. So Victor Rodriguez was originally supposed to be taking on Denis Bondar, a guy that I am so excited to see in the UFC. Now you get the short notice call-up out of Fight Ready, but also, again, the Pitbull Brothers gym and Bruno Silva. And if you wanted to see a small man that fights like a smaller version of Patricio Pitbull, but maybe without some of the finished qualities, Bruno Silva's your guy. Looked great against JP Bays last time out.
Bruno Silva was a fighter who, for the longest time, I disliked a lot of things about his game. I'll be completely honest about that. But he's one of those fighters, and we say this, hey, I don't think you're that thing until you are that thing. And sometimes it does take a really impressive performance for me to change my opinion about a fighter. But that's exactly what Bruno Silva went out there and did against JP Bays. And hey, maybe you're not that fired up about JP after how bad he looked in that fight. But Bruno Silva, I just think, did everything right. We finally saw what we were sort of promised when he first came to the UFC. You saw the power. You saw the wrestling. You just saw the overall package of Bruno Silva. And that's the thing. With Bruno Silva, I love the power he has on the feet. I love his wrestling. I love his submissions offensively and defensively. But my issue with Bruno Silva is that he's one of these fighters, so we can talk about how good his offensive grappling is. He does struggle when other guys start to wear on him. And I do always worry about that with Bruno Silva. But that's the thing. Going into the Bays fight, I thought, okay, well, Bruno Silva, he can tire as the fight goes on. JP Bays, pretty good wrestler. I didn't see any of that, though. I just saw Bruno Silva, who wasn't looking to grapple just because he's good at it. He wasn't grappling, so he knew he wouldn't get tired as the fight went on. He was fighting in just a much smarter way than I'd ever seen him fight before. And I do think at some point you just have to take your hat off and say, listen, Bruno Silva, you're not the fighter that I originally thought you were. And for Silva, again, I can't say enough good things about him after that last performance. And maybe you don't think JP Bays is la creme de la creme, but like, Bruno Silva went out there and did exactly what he was asked to do. He put on a great performance against a really hyped up prospect. So again, I can't say any more great things about Bruno Silva coming into this fight.
And for Silva, made it competitive against David Dvorak. It lends credence to what you said. Defensively, you know, maybe there's a little bit to be desired. He could have beaten Tagir Ulanbekov, depending on who you asked. True. And that was a fight where he's a really big underdog. And in the fight against Bays, I know we both had Bays in that one, but you're right. Silva looked amazing in that one. For Rodriguez, you can't focus too much on the one fight against Yanez. He was on the back foot for most of it. He took it on really short notice. He weighed in at an odd spot. And again, this one at 125 pounds. He was 133 for that fight at 135. I'd say he's undersized, but then you look at Victor Rodriguez when he was fighting in Alaska. So let's go through it for a bit. We already talked about the Mazurek fight. He weighs in. 135 is the fight. The fight at Metal and Mayhem 2 against John George. That one's at bantamweight. Before that, Blood, Sweat, and Beers. That one was at featherweight. Before that, Alaska FC 138 at featherweight. And so on and so forth. So maybe the fight at flyweight, that was the way to go. Maybe he was already on his way to flyweight. He thought the call would come to the UFC. Victor Rodriguez, really, really heavy-handed. Really, really explosive guy. I worry so much about the gas tank and the level of opposition that he faced with Alaska FC. If he beats Bruno Silva, same thing. With Silva beating Bays, maybe all of a sudden Victor Rodriguez takes a big jump up in stock in my mind. But this is a really tough ask. Even against Bondar, it would have been a tough fight because Bondar is just going to wear on you, take you down, rinse and repeat.
Bruno Silva can play that game too, but he can also play with you on the feet.
100%. And the other thing I don't really love in the game of Victor Rodriguez is the fact that he's a guy who winds up a lot on his punches. You can talk about how heavy-handed he is. Sometimes that is a gift and a curse. And I do feel like the drawbacks for Victor Rodriguez is he's not that accurate because of it. He does have to wind up on his shots a lot. And I understand Adrian Yanez is going to be knocking out a lot of guys for a long time. But you can even see in the short amount of time that fight was going on, Yanez could read him every single time. And when he does fight those strikers who are the, I won't say power-based strikers, but more accuracy and speed-based strikers, I do think they're going to be able to clip him on the chin. Now, the great thing is that in this Bruno Silva matchup, this could come down to two guys just throwing big shots in the middle of the cage, and either guy can land at that point. But at the end of the day, I just like the overall game of Bruno Silva a little bit more. And the other thing I have to say is, a guy who can still improve after he is 30 years of age, which is normally kind of like the threshold of, oh, they've sort of plateaued as an athlete, and if anything, they're going to start regressing athletically. But for Bruno Silva, honestly, he's shown the ability to improve even at this later stage of his career, and I just gotta take my hat off to him.
For Bruno Silva coming in here, pretty big favorite. Open a minus 300. He's now a minus 341. For Victor Rodriguez, open a plus 250. He's a plus 263. If we have a look on Tapology, it's a surprise to us as it is to you. Ooh. 943 total votes, 86% Silva, 66% by knockout. For the 14% that have Rodriguez, 53% by knockout. Again, maybe does something to surprise us. I'm eager to see the weight cut. Again, you're part of the way there at 133, I guess, so to speak, his last time out. But full camp, you're getting ready for Bondar, the grappler, Bruno Silva, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, trains with some of the best in the world, and the Pitbull brothers, Henry Cejudo, whoever they happen to feature at Fight Ready in Arizona. But yeah, I like Bruno Silva in this fight as well. I had a lot of question marks about Victor Rodriguez coming into the UFC. I was halfway surprised this is the guy that they went with. No disrespect to Victor. I think he has a good opportunity here. And hey, with a big win over Silva, wow, all of a sudden you're on the radar at 125 pounds. Oh, yeah. But I am edging Bruno. The Bulldog Silva, Matt, you have Silva as well. Really looking forward to this fight. You're not going to want to miss the rest of the fight coverage for this week. The lighter weight classes are on fire. Font Garbrandt, the main event. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Ultimate Fighter fans, rejoice. We have Court the Crusher McGee. He's going to be taking on one of my guys, Claudio Silva. Matt, I absolutely love this fight. And I've got some of these fighters that you'll hear every now and again. And it sucks for me when they really reach the main stage. Like Piotr Jan, hardcore all the way up through with the ACB and so on and so forth. Claudio Silva has been one of those guys. He's like my Leonardo Santos. And it's not just strictly Brazilian fighters or Russian fighters. But with Claudio Silva, what can this guy not do? You look at the fights that he's had in the UFC. He made his debut years and years and years ago, back in 2014. Picked up a big win over Brad Scott. After that, he got a big one over Leon Edwards.
You might have heard of him.
Leon Edwards. He beat him by split decision. Finished Nordin Taleb. Finished Hot Chocolate Danny Roberts. Finished the not ready for primetime Cole Williams. And then he took some more time off. That's been the whole story. So for Claudio Silva, he fights Leon Edwards in 2014. His next fight is mid-2018. He was looking to kind of get through some of the injuries. He's moved around with fight camps. I remember there was a point where he's training in Birmingham. There's a point where he's training at London Shoot Fighters. He's been in the States at American Top Team. For this one, he's in Brazil. You'll see that in our graphic. But with Claudio Silva, one of the most credentialed grapplers you're going to find in all of MMA. And his last time out, after over a year away, he lost the decision to James Krause, where it was just like, hey, where's the Claudio I know? Where is he?
Claudio Silva to Craig is like Pepe Silva to Charlie Day. Like, Craig wanted to know where he was for those few years when he was away. And it was weird because it does feel like every division has one or two of these fighters where it's like, damn, every time they compete, I'm really excited to watch them fight. And then 18 months go by and you're like, wait, where have they been? And Claudio Silva, I don't want to say dark horse because I don't ever felt like he was active enough to be
almost 39.
Not a great age to be at welterweight. But he was one of those fighters where it's like, oh, he's fighting Nordin Taleb, that'll be a good fight. Then he chokes him out with ease. And you're like, oh man, oh, okay. After you beat a guy like Taleb, normally you're going to start fighting other guys, you know, that top 25 to 15 range. And then we just didn't see that for Claudio Silva. And it was unfortunate too, because like you had said, we talked about his grappling acumen, all of his BJJ grappling experience and whatnot. This is a guy who's a decent fighter all around, honestly. And it really is unfortunate that we did miss out on kind of year like 33 to 38 of his career, just due to the fact that he hasn't been able to get opponents. And the last year after the James Crows fight, be it what it may with the pandemic and all that, but it really is unfortunate that it feels like we've missed out on a lot of the best years of this guy's career. Now, the great news is that this matchup with Court McGee is actually a really, really fun fight for, I guess I'll use the term hardcore, but this is a fun fight for anybody if you like MMA, because in Court McGee, he's just tough. And again, he's much more than just tough. But when I think about Court McGee, it's his cardio. It's his durability. It's those attributes that you immediately think of when you do think of the crusher at 170. Because Court McGee's been around for a very long time. This is a guy who beat Robert Whittaker at 170 at one point. Now, yes, controversial split decision. But like, still, he beat Robert Whittaker, who's definitely going to be in the UFC Hall of Fame one day. So this is the type of guy we're dealing with Court McGee. The only issue is that I do feel like we can finally say that we're over the hump with Court McGee. He can at least see the clubhouse from where he's golfing at right now. He can still put in competitive performances just based on his style, because his style has always kind of been that grimy wrestler who has good enough stand-up to get by. He's a way better striker getting into the clinch than like Kevin Holland is, so that's worth something. But Court McGee is going to bring the fight to Claudio Silva, and I think that's the thing that everyone's going to be looking forward to, because in Claudio Silva, he's got okay striking, he's got okay wrestling, but we all know how good his jiu-jitsu is, and when you're fighting a guy like Court McGee, who will be looking for the takedown, who will try to make things ugly on the feet, I just think stylistically this could turn into a really fun fight.
With Court McGee, his last win was in our home province. I was there for it. He beat Alex Garcia. How crazy is that? Remember, Alex Garcia was another one of those guys. Like, hey, this guy's a great wrestler. He's out of Cuba. He's got a really good potential. He was a little older too, but a great win for Court McGee. One of the most polite people I've met in the entire sport. Now, how far does politeness bring you? Well, you talked about it. He had a huge win over Robert Whittaker, as controversial as it might be. But the 5-on-in, well, 1-4. And you look at the last three fights. He lost to Diego Lima by split decision 2 years ago. He lost to Sean Brady by decision, where he got thoroughly out-wrestled. And then he lost to Carlos Condit, where he got outstruck. In kind of an odd fight, like he just kept pressing forward. And Condit, who has really, I wouldn't say regressed, I'm just going to say has slowed down with his striking with age, was still able to land a lot of shots against Court McGee in a fun fight. It was competitive. I enjoyed it. The Sean Brady fight was kind of like a passing of the torch, because it was like, well, I used to be good at some of this stuff. Now Sean Brady, well, he's really good at some of this stuff. So for Court McGee, it's a tricky matchup. For Claudio Silva, again, you look at the 5-on-in, but they're spread out so far. The fifth to last fight was almost 7 years ago against Leon Edwards. The Cole Williams fight, his last win, but you saw what Jason Witt was able to do to Cole Williams. Like, Cole Williams wasn't the best welterweight we've ever seen in the UFC. So for Claudio Silva, definitely needs a win to stay relevant whatsoever. Court McGee needs another win to stick around.
So in the last video you had mentioned, like, Adrian Yanez is fighting Randy Costa, a fight that's like, wow, these two super prospects, they're both really exciting, both really young, and they're both probably going to be ranked fighters in the near future. This fight's kind of the bizarro version of that. This is, hey, these are two guys near the end of their careers. Like, neither guy's probably going to be able to damage the other guy, all that. But like, I shouldn't say that because it's MMA, anything can happen, but like, it's not like Claudio Silva's Vicente Luque, and it's not like Court McGee is like Sean Brady. Like, this is a good fight for both guys at where they are in their respective careers. It's weird though, because honestly, everything in my body tells me that Court McGee is probably going to lose this fight. But I feel like old man Court McGee is just one of those matchups who, if he can put it to Claudio Silva and avoid getting taken down himself, I don't think Claudio Silva is a good enough striker to really run away with this fight on the feet. And I don't know if Claudio Silva is a good enough grappler to take Court McGee down. So at the end of the day, I'm just left asking myself, can Court McGee out-volume strike Claudio Silva on the feet? I mean, yeah, I think it could happen. Stranger things have happened in the UFC, don't get me wrong. Andre Muniz broke Jacare's arm last week, and I said Jacare
silly
will never get submitted ever. So I will concede that, yes, Claudio Silva could win, but I do think I'm picking Court McGee in this one.
I have a hard time with it, too. I mean, it's a pop and popcorn fight for me. Claudio Silva, you know, notwithstanding, like, it is a really tough one, especially when Court McGee goes out and gets matched so evenly with somebody else. So if we do have a look at the odds, they are very close. Silva open up a favorite, about a minus 150 or thereabouts. He's a minus 110 right now. McGee open a plus 130. He's about, well, a minus 110 right now. So we're splitting hairs. They're relatively closely matched. Out of the Tapology votes, I think it's insane. I do agree with you. It's closer than this. 989 total votes, 86% Silva. You got 52% by decision, 40% by submission. For the 14% that I'm McGee, 69% have him to win by decision. I agree with you. I see it as a really close fight, but for Court McGee, to volume strike, he's not like, he throws the jab.
I didn't say it was going to be pretty, Chris.
Yeah, I have a really hard time with that. And if Court McGee goes, typical Court McGee, you might want to take him down. You can't fiddle around with that kind of stuff with Silva. Can James Krause do it? A little bit younger, a little bit more fleet of foot? Sure he can. But I do like Claudio Silva in this fight. Again, with the striking, with the jiu-jitsu, complete mix. The training camp, little iffy, spending some time in Brazil. But again, I still do like Claudio Silva in this fight.
Yeah, this fight is a coin flip. I got to be very honest with that. I do think Court McGee can do enough to defend the takedown. And I do think he can accumulate enough volume throughout the rounds to just win rounds at the end of the day. But this is an extremely close fight on paper between two guys in the twilight of their MMA careers.
Garbage fight. This usually pads somebody's stats because I have Claudio Silva to get the win. You have Court McGee. That's why we call it a garbage fight. But really love it. Popping popcorn as well. Absolutely love this card. Font and Garbrandt at the top. You're not going to want to miss that. So stick around with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Huge fight this weekend at heavyweight. And I mean huge. We have the former super heavyweight Chris Barnett making his UFC debut, taking on big Ben Rothwell. Matt, for Ben Rothwell, I'm tired of talking about Ben Rothwell fighting Felipe Lins. He was supposed to fight him what? A few months ago, then this month, and then all three of those fights fell out. Felipe Lins couldn't make the walk. So, who does the UFC call? Not Chris Barnett. They give the call to Askar Magomedov. And I thought, oh, okay, I've seen this guy before. You know, big tattoos on his neck, big strong guy. But if you look at Magomedov, he was supposed to fight Jordan Young with the PFL at 205. That was on short notice. He weighed in, then the fight fell through, and I thought, like, this doesn't make any sense at all. Why would you make him fight at heavyweight? Why would he fight Ben Rothwell? This isn't the guy to give the call to. The guy to give the call to is a guy that Bleacher Report said in 2014 would be a guy to watch at heavyweight. And now we're 7 years later and Chris Barnett. And listen, this guy probably should have been in the UFC a long time ago. He's so much fun to watch. He throws spin kicks to the body. He'll throw head kicks. He throws spinning back fists. Like, this is one of the most athletic guys that you're going to find at 265 plus pounds. And that's the thing. So much fun to watch. And really,
you're talking about Ben Rothwell right now, right?
I'm talking about Chris Barnett. He's 5'9" and he's a heavyweight. And you'd think just to look at him, and I get the comparisons. They're out there on the internet. You've heard them said, but I'll say them anyway. He looks just like Mark Henry. He looks like the world's strongest man. Is he going to curl a frying pan on the way in? Probably not. But Chris Barnett, I love what he brings to the table. He comes out of Barnett's Taekwondo. If you go check out his Instagram, he has a lot of fun. I watched a video today where he's saying Shania Twain in his car by himself on a roadie. So that's cool. Maybe it was weird on my part to watch it, but I do the deep dives for the people. But you look at the names that Chris Barnett was supposed to take on before his last fight, which was Ollie Thompson's coach at super heavyweight, where he knocked him out in the first round. He was supposed to fight Bigfoot Silva, Jack May, and Brett Martin. He's supposed to fight Martin for a title at the end of this month. Now he's coming in on short notice. Now for Martin, he's probably the next big thing at heavyweight. If you haven't heard of him on the regional scene, just wait, because he will be that guy. But Chris Barnett, I'm excited. I'm interested.
I never thought we were going to see Javi Ayala in the UFC, and this might be the closest we ever get, honestly, because Chris Barnett has that kind of athleticism, and that's the only other heavyweight who comes to mind where I'm like, wait, your body type can perform those types of athletic abilities? Because it is kind of deceiving.
It's like if Chris Farley was a fighter, it's Chris Barnett.
Like if he was the Beverly Hills Ninja, it would be great, because Chris Barnett does bring a certain level of excitement that you don't really often have in the heavyweight division. He does bring that kind of Johnny Walker-ness to the heavyweights where it's like, okay, any fight, this guy can either get knocked out by throwing a spinning back fist and walking into a big shot, or could knock his opponent out by throwing a spinning back fist. And fighting a guy like Ben Rothwell, it'll be interesting, right? Because Ben Rothwell is either going to just try to extinguish that fire, hold you against the fence, and not do anything for 15 minutes, or he's going to emulate Dominic Cruz like Craig just did. He's going to have that really fun movement on the feet, he's going to pump out the jab, and he will play with you at range a little bit. So that's a really weird thing with Ben Rothwell. I'm curious to see what level of respect Ben Rothwell has to the power of Chris Barnett, because you have to think, Ben Rothwell's been in there with some of the greatest fighters of all time. He's fought the greatest of the greats, and he's not a guy who gets knocked out all that often. It's not like he's an Alistair Overeem where it's like, okay, when he loses, it's normally by TKO. This is a guy who's eaten some of the biggest shots from some of the biggest fighters in the world. Even go back to when he beat Overeem. Look at when he lost to JDS. Like, yes, he lost by decision, but this is a guy who is known of having one of the best chins in the heavyweight division, and that's why this matchup's so much fun, because he's going to have to test it against one of the more unique strikers that the UFC especially now has that heavyweight.
Ben Rothwell hasn't been knocked out since his UFC debut against Cain Velasquez at UFC 104 back in 2009. So it's been a while. Has he been finished since then? Yeah, Gonzaga subbed him, like you said. That's about it. Like, the guy doesn't really get finished. He has been in some boring fights as of recently. Ovince St. Preux wasn't really the best fight at 265 pounds. Marcin Tybura, it was more fun than I advertised it at, but Tybura looked pretty good in that one. And then the fight before, he fought Stefan Struve, where Dan Mergliotta kind of gave him benefit of the doubt with the cup shots. And we just kept fighting until Ben Rothwell finished him. But coming into this fight, again, you got ready for Linz. There was that weird episode of Embedded where Stipe was getting on the plane, and who happens to be on the plane? It's Ben Rothwell. And Stipe goes, "Hey, man, who are you going to be fighting?"
Cool.
And Ben Rothwell goes, "Felipe Linz?" Well, did he have to do that? Like it was like so Groundhog Day, because it happened three times. And now we get this fight. And so Chris Barnett comes in here, and again, I hate to just keep tossing references, but it's just like that Billy Talent song. "There's nothing to lose when no one knows your name." In a fight like this, where Barnett, nothing to lose. Ben Rothwell, he's not a ranked fighter anymore, but he's on the cusp, or he's thereabout. He's kind of like the ultimate gatekeeper. I know Arlovsky's kind of surpassed him for that title, but Ben Rothwell, still in the mix. He's still the king of Kenosha. His wife just had their child. Congrats. The name is Odin, so that's kind of neat. They named the kid Odin. But yeah, Matt, I look at this fight, Ben Rothwell. If he's going to get the win, it's a classic Ben Rothwell fight. He's going to smother him. He's going to get him up against the cage. And for Chris Barnett, he's never been submitted in the past. And he's been on some big shows before. Never been subbed. But maybe this is the first time. You never know.
Okay, I'm going to have some pushback on that. Because Ben Rothwell's not really a wrestler. Like, when he gets submissions, if he has other guys are shooting on him. And he has good defensive submissions. But, like, he's got that weird go-go choke that he gets under the chin. He's got great guillotines. But I don't look at Ben Rothwell as a guy who's going to look at Chris Barnett and say, "Hey, I'm going to automatically put wrestling shoes on and try to get this guy to rear naked choke." I think he's going to wrestle him, don't get me wrong. But I don't just think the fact that Ben Rothwell is going to use wrestling will automatically mean that he'll be searching for the submission because of it. But at the end of the day, do I think Ben Rothwell cannot get knocked out and make a fight boring? Well, yeah, I think Ben Rothwell's pretty much made a career at doing that, and that's kind of why I have to pick him in this fight. If Chris Barnett wins this, it's going to be all over Twitter. ESPN's going to retweet it 9 times, because this is going to be one of those, like, okay, probably not Showtime kicks, because I doubt the cage could hold up to him bouncing off it, but, you know, one of those crazy kind of historic highlights. But at the end of the day, I just think Ben Rothwell's ability to put out a fire is going to win him this fight. If he can use his pressure in a smart way, crash all that space, don't let Barnett use his kicks, I think Ben Rothwell can win another decision.
It's a tricky one, because, I mean, you see the tape out there on Barnett, you see the names coming into this one, the last five, Alexandru Lungo, Robert Neal over with Island Fights, Gun Oh Shim over with Road FC. He had a tough fight against Rashawn Jackson. There were some really weird positions, like Rashawn Jackson at one point had his back, like totally had his back, and then Jackson just jumps off. Like, it was a really weird one. His last time out against Ahmed Johnny, who, again, it was supposed to be Ollie Thompson originally. Thompson jumped out on really short notice, so his coach stepped in, and they had the fight at super heavyweight. But I do love everything I've seen out of Beast Boy coming into this one. But I like it, you know, do you go with the wild flashy pick, or do you go with the safe pick? I got to go with the safe pick in this one, too. Ben Rothwell opened a minus 245 favorite. He's a minus 317 right now. For Barnett, opened a plus 185. He's a plus 247 right now. If you look at the Tapology votes, not really close. 948, 81% Rothwell, 54% by knockout. For the 19% that have Barnett, 61% by knockout. Again, maybe there's a submission like the time he submitted Josh Barnett. But I have a tough time with it. I like Ben Rothwell in this one. If it's going to be a win, I would have it by decision, maybe not by knockout. But I do love the fight. I'm so excited about this one.
Ben Rothwell ate clean overhands from JDS back when JDS was still pretty good. Like, he just fought for the title of the fight after the Rothwell fight. So when JDS was still, maybe not peak JDS, but still a pretty good version of him, he lit him up like a Christmas tree. And Ben Rothwell still didn't get knocked out and went a hard 5 rounds with a guy like Junior Santos. That's why I have to go with Ben Rothwell. But like you said, it's kind of like the sexy pick of Chris Barnett, because it could be that crazy knockout that we're all going to be talking about. Or is it going to be one of those classic Ben Rothwell, like, hey, you're probably going to get a lot more clinch than you like in this fight. But yeah, I like Ben Rothwell.
Absolutely love the fight. We're both going with Milwaukee's own, Wisconsin's own, the King of Kenosha, Ben Rothwell. Absolutely love the fight. Big time card. Font taking on Garbrandt in the main event. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend. We've got Bill Algeo, Senor Perfecto, taking on Ricardo Ramos. Matt, I absolutely love this fight, but we just talked about it a few weeks ago. So we're going to throw it back to the old prediction video. We're going to update the odds. We're going to give our final pick and prediction on this one. And listen, there's not a lot of people from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Anyway, I did the research for Bill Algeo's last fight, and I talked all about it. So I'm done with that. What I will focus on is the fact that for Bill Algeo, it was strength of schedule coming into the UFC. And yeah, the guy's got 5 losses to 14 wins. But you look at the last 2, and hey, Brendan Lochnane on Contender Series, that's going to happen. Everyone and their dog thought that Brendan Lochnane deserved a UFC contract, and Dana White said no. I'm like, Roger Goodell, I don't want to have fun. Not signing him. PFL, fill your boots. So for the man himself, Algeo, he goes back to CFFC, beats Tim Dueling, recognizable regional name, and then he gets the call to fight Ricardo Lamas. And in that fight, it's a loss. It's a decision loss. And if you only watch the 3rd round, Lamas went off. But in the first 2 rounds, it was closer than that. And Bill Algeo actually, you know, put in good work. I was really impressed with him. So in his next time out, did I pick Bill Algeo to beat Spike Carlisle? Honestly, I can't remember at this point. I'd be honest if I could. I can't remember, but he sent Spike Carlisle packing to LFA, and he absolutely owned. So for Bill Algeo, what do you know? This guy's baseline good at everything. He's a decent striker. He has decent cardio, except for in the Lamas fight. But they went back and forth like crazy.
Also, Lamas, one of the best featherweights of all time who's never got a belt. So if you lose to him on very short notice, that's no big deal.
He can really do just about everything quite well for Bill Algeo. For Ricardo Ramos, I have zero idea what this guy's baseline is. Because on one day, honest to goodness, I think he's a top 10 UFC featherweight. I'm not lying. He's only 25 years old. He's out of Brazil. He trains at Team Alpha Male. You look at the corner. Raymond Daniels is training with him. You got Alex Munoz that's on this card. So with Daniels, excellent striking coach. With Alex Munoz, excellent wrestling coaching. You're really going to get all of those things. With Ricardo Ramos, rather, he's a guy that came in on Dana White's Looking for a Fight, Bangor Maine edition. Been there and done that with NEF, but you look at that fight, and you look at what he's been able to do in the UFC, and it's kind of a mixed bag, because on his best day, he's beating Ayman Zahabi, and he's looking amazing. Double spins, finishes him, looks great. And then you look at the losses. I mean, Lerone Murphy, I think he's a great fighter. I really do like Lerone Murphy, but Murphy was able to dismantle him, and when he had Ramos hurt, he turtled up like he was totally done. His grappling's good. He's a good jiu-jitsu practitioner, but his wrestling's weird. It's not great offensively, but it's good defensively. He can get really tired, and that's another thing. For a young guy to get tired like that, I worry about it. But again, when Ricardo Ramos is on, in my mind's eye, he's a good, good fighter, and he has a very high potential. So for me, it's almost like Ramos has a very high ceiling. For Bill Algeo, he's never going to win the featherweight title. I don't think he is. I'm sure Bill does. I'm sure his gym even thinks it. Everybody around him thinks it. So I'm not saying that to, you know, poo-poo Bill Algeo. To me, Ramos has a very high ceiling. He's a much younger fighter. But this is a weird one.
You did with Ricardo Ramos what I did with Jonathan Martinez. So I'm just going to tell you now. He's never going to be in the top 10 of the featherweight division or the bantamweight division. He can have good fights with some guys, but here's the problem with Ricardo Ramos. And I think we're sort of, I don't know if we're the victims or if we're the people putting it out. He doesn't have that much knockout power. Yeah, the knockout against Ayman Zahabi was great, but I do think Ramos is one of those guys who, he's a victim to his own highlight reel, if that makes any sense whatsoever. When I think of Ricardo Ramos, of course the first thing I think of is that double spinning elbow against Ayman Zahabi, but that's what I fixate on, and I look away from the fact that, well, he doesn't deal with pressure all that well. He has good striking technique, but that's really the problem. He doesn't have enough pop to put guys down with his striking, but he doesn't have the cardio to really overwhelm guys with his volume. And for Ramos, you about the wrestling, for me, if he just had cardio, he'd be that much better of a fighter, because if he could match his output with his jiu-jitsu credentials, I do think we'd have a very dangerous fighter here. Could you imagine if Ricardo Ramos could go out there, throw a lot of volume against the cage to a guy, make them sort of cover up, and then take them down? You're dealing with a very dangerous fighter. My problem is,
Hamosh is a guy who will just throw single shots. And a lot of his single shots, they do look nice. He has a nice spinning back kick to the body, for instance. It looks kind of Max Holloway-ish when you look at it by itself. But my problem is, there's nothing that comes after that spinning back kick to the body. He will just kind of stand there and look at his opponent in the mirror. And one thing Aljo is really good at, even just go back to the Llamas fight, and he lost that fight. When Llamas would stand there at range and try to make reads on Aljo, Algio's rangy and awkward for this division. And he can throw really weird techniques. And he's a guy who, he lifts his leg before he throws the kick. I know that's a very weird thing, but I wanted to make sure I talked about this for Robert Whittaker, so I feel like I have to for Algio. He doesn't throw kicks in a traditional sense where he brings his whole leg up at once. He'll bring his knee up, and then he flicks out his leg at the end. It's interesting because the kick won't have as much power behind it, but you're going to find openings in your opponent's defense a lot better when you throw kicks that way. And that's something Algio is actually really good at doing. So for Ricardo Hamosh, I just don't know how he's going to get this floor to the mat. And even if he does get the fight to the mat, Matt, I don't think it's a cakewalk for him. And Algio, I agree with you. I don't think he is going to have the featherweight strap at any point. I don't think he's going to be a top five guy. But I do think he's going to offer a very hard fight and a very fun fight for anybody outside of the top five. I really do think that. If Algio, I can see him being one of those names where, oh, a top five featherweight matchup falls out. They just throw his name in there. Will he beat the guy who he's matched up with? No, but I can see that being a fight of the night type of fight. So for Algio, I just see him having the higher ceiling out of these two.
For me, if you look at Hamo, the perfect kind of comparison fight that he's already had, the split decision win over Kyung Ho Gong, and he's a very, very good grappler. He can really wrestle quite well. You want to watch an exciting fighter that you don't hear enough about? Kyung Ho Gong is that fighter. If Hamosh fights like that, maybe he could beat Bill Algio. For Bill Algio, you just got to wear on him. You just got to close that distance, create that gap. And for Hamosh, I think of him more as a distance striker. Again, with Zahabi, it was in tight with those elbows. It was behind the black lines. He was able to do it. But for the most part, it's a lot of long, rangy attacks. And if you can pressure him, you can beat him. All right, Matt. So getting back to the odds, this one has Algio now at a minus 120 or thereabouts. The odds haven't really changed this week. Hamosh coming back about a plus 100. And if we have a look over on Tapology for the total votes, really close. 959 total votes, 58% going with Hamosh, 74% by decision for the 42% that have Algio, 81% by decision. Now for Bill Algio, again, he was a guy coming into the UFC. You looked at it. Like, he had lost to Brennan Lochnane on Contender Series where, hey, Dana, go look at the PFL right now. Brennan Lochnane might win the season. You never know. And then you look at the fight after that. Algio gets beat by Llamas. But before that third round, he didn't look too bad. He didn't look like a fish out of water. And then he beat Spike Carlisle. Pretty impressive. For Hamosh, again, the five on in. Little bit spread out. Still a young prospect coming out of Team Alpha Male. I absolutely love the fight. So what's the final pick here?
It's a weird fight, honestly, because the odds are close. But I gotta be honest, I like Bill Algio a lot in this fight. And I don't know if it's just because I don't like a lot of what I've seen out of Ricardo Hamosh. But up at 145 pounds, I just don't think that's Hamosh's best division. I think him at 135 is the more ideal weight class. Because now you're fighting Bill Algio, who's a massive 145.
Big
like,
guy.
He basically looks like a lightweight. When he fought Ricardo Llamas, he looked way bigger than Llamas, who not only is a really, really good featherweight, but a guy who was at the top of the division too, and a big featherweight. So I just think it's a weird fight for Hamosh. I'm a little bit, I guess, just flabbergasted as to why so many people on Tapology think he's going to win and why the odds are so close. Because like you had mentioned with Algio, so you lost to Brennan Lochnane and Ricardo Llamas. Who cares? There's a lot of fighters who have a lot worse losses on their record. So for me, I'm pretty surprised that the odds are as close as they are.
I like Bill Algio as well. Really close fight. I can't wait to see the comments down below because Matt is high on Bill Algio. And I like Algio as well.
He's not Jonathan Martinez, but I do think he's going to do well.
For Hamosh, I do like that Team Alpha Male connection. He has plenty of teammates fighting on this card, including Cody Garbrandt up at the top. And Yan Xiaonan, who's fighting in the co-main event. But yeah, both of us going with Bill Algio in the fight. Absolutely love it. Like I said, Font Garbrandt in the main event. Esparza taking on Yan Xiaonan in the co-main event. You're not going to want to miss that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time fight coming up this weekend at middleweight. We have ranked contenders, the Joker, Jack Hermanson, taking on, well, it is an Oscar De La Hoya, although he might fight this summer. I don't really know. But the golden boy, Edmund Shahbazyan. And at some point, you got to become the golden man. But this boy's been fighting since he was 9. He entered the gym. He started training with Ronda Rousey as a teenager. That's where everybody really heard of him. And yeah, Edmund got a little bit more shine than his brother did, Leon. And really, we just haven't seen Leon on the big stage so much. But for Edmund, Man, the guy looked like a force for a long time until his last fight. But even before then, great striker, has a bit of a Shotokan karate background. You see it with the kicks that he offers up. Great forward pressure. He's the type of guy that throws one of my favorite moves in all of MMA. Pop, pop. Going for the double jab. I love to see it. Edmund Shahbazyan, very, very effective use of the jab. Combined with his footwork, there's a lot of fundamentals that you can see that are there that were really pumped into him at a young age. And he's one of those new wave MMA fighters that we've seen. Opposite him, Jack Hermanson. This is a guy that when he beat Jacare the way that he beat him. Now listen, Jacare wins. But the way that Jack Hermanson did it, that was the way. Like, that was crazy to see that. And then you look at the five on in. So again, we get the win over David Branch, crazy. The win over Jacare, great. The loss to Jared Cannonier, yikes, because that was like a bit of a hometown crowd and didn't go all that well for Jack. He beats Kelvin Gastelum quickly by heel hook, which was Kelvin off on that night? I don't know.
It was one position.
It was insane. And then he loses to Marvin Vettori. Now, Matt, this is the question that I have for you when I hand it off. Marvin Vettori fighting for the title coming up shortly. That was a fight where, did you lose stock in Hermanson in a loss, or was it just kind of a wash?
It's a great question, because I think that Marvin Vettori finally showed us what we already knew in that fight. But it's weird, because Jack Hermanson and Edmund Shahbazyan are both in a very similar point in their career. Because if you really want to overanalyze both guys, really just best wins, you can say, okay, Jack Hermanson beat up an old Jacare Souza, and he beat Kelvin Gastelum in one position. Because that fight came down to one position. Whether you think Gastelum was on or off that night, he got out-grappled by Jack Hermanson in a battle of leg locks. And yes, he shouldn't have been in that position to begin with, but if you're going to get into that kind of battle with Jack Hermanson, you're going to lose. I don't care who you are. Unless your name's Gordon Ryan, those just aren't the types of exchanges you're going to want to be getting in with Jack Hermanson. But I do feel like in Hermanson, you do have one of the more limited contenders, I would say, at the middleweight division. And let me just elaborate a little bit on that. When I think about the middleweight division, you have guys like Israel Adesanya, who is just this phenomenal striker. He's got great takedown defense.
At middleweight.
But he is really the only specialist at that weight division. You look at guys like Robert Whittaker. You look at guys like Kelvin Gastelum. Guys like Darren Till. Guys like Jared Cannonier. Just anyone who is a top contender there. They're kind of good at everything. And the one thing that Jack Hermanson struggles with is the striking. Which is weird, because I would say the biggest showcase he's ever had in the UFC was, I guess, his striking against Jacare Souza. But if you go back and you look at that fight, he was able to out-volume Jacare, which is an impressive task, don't get me wrong, but that's the least impressive way to beat a guy like Jacare Souza. And I understand, beating a guy like Jacare for 25 minutes, there's going to be people out there, oh, Matt, how can you not be impressive? Just hear me out. It's not like he was able to draw Jacare, and he barely outstruck him. Like, he ate a bunch of big power shots from Jacare, and in the fourth and fifth round, Jacare was the one who was starting to make the fight close, because Jack Hermanson had just got off to such a big lead in the first three rounds. And yes, Jack Hermanson is a good gas tank, don't get me wrong, and I'm not worried about him at all in a three-round fight. But I just think with Jack Hermanson, it's not like he's Robert Whittaker. It's not like he's a fighter who, okay, every second I'm on the feet after worry because I can get knocked out. And oh my goodness, if he takes me down, he's this really good black belt and he can submit me. With Hermanson, you really only have to worry about the grappling when you are an elite fighter. And with Shahbazyan, it's weird, right? Because you have the weird fight against Darren Stewart. I know we've talked about that fight probably too much at this point, but just a weird fight where he was more of the wrestler in that matchup. And then you look at how good he looks against Brad Tavares and you're like, wow, like, this guy has all the accuracy in the world and great power on his shots. What is the ceiling? Then you look at the Derek Brunson fight. And Derek Brunson's weird, because is he a gatekeeper? Is he the best middleweight ever? Like, no one really knows.
We need to see another round of that fight?
Probably not. That fight definitely could have been stopped after the second. But Edmund gets off to a great start, starts looking good, and then the second round comes around. And it's not only that he started to get hit in that fight, it was that he started to tire as well. And once you mix in, well, head trauma with a poor gas tank, that is just a recipe for disaster. And I think we did see the limitations of Shahbazyan's game in that fight. But the weird thing, even going back to that fight, is Shahbazyan had success, and he always does have success in his fights. But I'm gonna, and again, I've gone on for a walk, Craig, I apologize, but I'm gonna quote Teddy Atlas here. I think Edmund Shahbazyan has a little bit of like Mike Tyson quality in him, where when the going gets tough, he can't get tougher. And I talked about this with fighters all the time. There was a fighter last week, like Charles Oliveira, people said that about him until he was able to go out there and really prove the point otherwise. With Shahbazyan, I saw him panic wrestle a ton against Darren Stewart because he started to get hit on the feet. And I saw him panic against Derek Brunson and try to wrestle the guy who's a much better wrestler, who is Derek Brunson. My concern is that when Edmund Shahbazyan panics and goes back to what he is most basic at, or what his natural instincts are, well, you brought it up, he doesn't have a background in any singular martial arts.
out. This is the thing that I think about a lot. When guys get hurt or when guys panic, they do what their background is. There's guys who become panic wrestlers when they get hurt.
Shotokan karate.
Okay, but if Shotokan karate is your backup, then why isn't he going out there and knocking people out like Wonder Boy? My problem with Shabazian is he doesn't have that default to go back to. Edmund Shabazian's default is, well, striking, I would say, but even in striking, he's going to get outstruck by the top guys in the division. So Shabazian, I think this really is one of those fights where I have this thought about Edmund Shabazian. I think he's a decent prospect with a ceiling of, like, maybe top 15 on his best day. If he goes out there and beats Jack Hermanson, let's say he knocks him out in the first round, I'm going to completely change my opinion on Edmund Shabazian. But as it stands right now, I'm going to be honest, I think he's a little bit too hyped up.
I have a really hard time with this fight because if you look at it from a pure numbers perspective, you got to consider the level of competition for Hermanson. He's been around with the company for longer. He's quite a bit older, 9 years older or thereabouts, and he's fought that high level. David Branch, double division champion with World Series, and yeah, his second UFC run wasn't very good. And yeah, Gerald Harris slam knocked him out the first time, but a good fighter on the ground. Jack Hermanson made it look like easy, like really, really easy. And you look at this fight, Shabazian has a negative strike differential in the UFC at -0.46. His 4.46 takedowns per 15 minutes, very impressive, or 4.44, at a 40% clip, and he's got 58% takedown defense. I don't know if I love that. You look at it for Hermanson, 75% takedown defense, 1.57 strike differential against heavy hitters and volume strikers. And yeah, his last time out, he fought both of those in Marvin Vettori. But Marvin Vettori's up here fighting for a title. Is Edmund Shabazian, like, is he right up there? I don't think so yet. That's why I have an issue with this one. So when I look at the odds, Hermanson opened a -115, is a -158 right now. For Edmund, he opened a -105, he's a +130. The Tapology votes, not very close. 1,027 of them, 74% Hermanson, 63% by submission. For the 26% that have Edmund to win, 70% by knockout. It's a possibility. For Hermanson, he got knocked out by Cannoneer. That was fairly quick, right? Quick enough. So it could happen. But again, I find myself leaning with the fighter out of Scandinavia in Jack Hermanson in this one because he's pretty well the complete package. He has great cardio. He can strike. His striking's not his best attribute, but he can strike. He gets hit. But again, positive strike differential. And in a fight like this, I still like him. But you might like Shabazian to get the win by knockout. I like Hermanson.
So this is the one thing about Jack Hermanson that we didn't even touch on yet. Jack Hermanson, it was weird. He was really famous for something until it felt like he got famous and people stopped talking about it. One of the best ground-and-pound fighters in the UFC. When he gets top position on guys, he makes them pay for it. And if you listen to any of his interviews, he talks about that. He loves ground-and-pound, and he is really good at getting into dominant positions. He doesn't just sit there. He postures up, and he rains down on his opponents. We saw Derek Brunson, who, yes, he's the better wrestler than Jack Hermanson, but I would argue he's not as good of a grappler as Hermanson is after he hits the mat. We saw the level of success he was able to have against Shabazian on the mat. I think if Jack Hermanson gets one takedown in this fight, he's really going to be able to put enough damage on Shabazian to where we do see not the same fighter in that second and third round because he will be so tired or so damaged. The last thing though, if Shabazian wins, it's going to be in the first round because Hermanson, the only thing he doesn't do all that well is he is hittable. Yes, he has a positive strike differential, but that's only because he has such a high level of volume himself. When he gets hit clean, and that does concern me in this matchup with Shabazian because Shabazian does have great accuracy. He does have good power early on in the fight. But other than that, like 3 minute window to start the fight, I do like Jack Hermanson.
Matt, both of us going with Jack Hermanson to get the win. Can't wait for the fight. Explosive middleweight action. We got a great fight in our main event, bantamweight Rob Font taking on Cody Garbrandt. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. All action flyweight matchup in this main card battle between Czech Republic's David Dvorak taking on Brazil's Howling Paiva. I absolutely love this one. David Dvorak, one of those guys that before his UFC debut, I got so excited about. He's the complete package. You see a lot of fighters recently coming in off Contender Series. They might have less than a dozen fights to their name and you think, oh, well, you know, he's a power puncher. She's a great grappler, so on and so forth. But the complete package really isn't there. For David Dvorak, great at striking, great moving forward, decent moving backward, great at grappling. He really has it all. And this is a guy that I was a little bit surprised. You know, he's kind of cut from the same cloth, and it's a cheap comparison, but it was the first thing that came to my mind. Jiří Procházka, the UFC came calling the first time. He said, no, I need more time to round things out. David Dvorak, and again, it's not the Czech connection. I'm not going to drop all my NHL references. Zdeno Chara, Peter Bondra, so on and so forth. Wow. The great sports stars of Czech Republic. But For David Dvorak, absolutely loved his game. And then you look at the fights that he's had so far in the UFC. It's a limited sample size. Bruno Silva, who's on this card as well. And then his last time out against Jordan Espinoza. And what's not to love? His leg kicks. Thunderous. You love to see that. He's taking on Haliem Paiva, one of the more technical strikers and precise strikers that we have at 125 pounds. And listen, I'll argue till the cows come home that he lost his last fight against Zhalgas Shumagulov. You can make the argument either way. I think Zhalgas won it. Before that, finished Mark De La Rosa. And then his first few fights in the UFC, he lost a split to Kai Kara France. He gets finished by Bontorin, but again, his eyebrow blew up. So you blame the eyebrow, you don't blame the fighter. In this fight, I love it. Explosive matchup. What are you thinking here?
This is a very, very fun fight. And for Haliem Paiva, it's an interesting UFC career because we talk about how good his striking is, but then you look at his losses and he did get outstruck in those fights. But you gotta understand, getting outstruck by a guy like Kai Kara France in a split decision, that was a close fight. Now, I did go back and rewatch it, thought Kai Kara France won 2-1, but it was a close and competitive matchup. And if you can have fights like that with Kai Kara France on the feet, then you prove that you belong in the UFC. And a loss to Bontorin, we saw how good he was, I guess, at bantamweight last weekend, so maybe that doesn't have as much weight behind it. But for Paiva, he is a really good striker. He's a hittable striker, though. And that's something that always does concern me, because with the thing with Paiva, anytime guys are standing over range with him, you know how good he is. His offensive leg kicks, you had mentioned that for Dvorak, Paiva's got really good ones as well. His really nice high stance. But the problem with Paiva is he can kind of wait because he is such a good counter striker, and it always does worry me when he fights guys with power at flyweight. Because in flyweight, you talk about at heavyweight, guys just have built-in knockout power. At flyweight, everybody has speed. And when you are the slower guy at the weight class, you're going to be the much more hittable guys. So for Paiva, the loss to Bontorin does concern me a little bit, but I do think this fight is going to be absolute fireworks between him and Dvorak.
For Haliem Paiva, kind of doing an interesting thing. We have Hamosh earlier on in the card training at a Team Alpha Male. You have Cody Garbrandt right up at the top. Haliem Paiva's been at Team Alpha Male training. Yan Xiaonan on this card as well. So you like to see that out of him. He's a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, what looks like a black belt around his waist with Clube de Judo Ranildo Nobre, so that's kind of neat. He was originally supposed to take on a different opponent back in the fall, being Amir Albazi, but he had to pull out of that one. What I found on it, right ACL tear was what they said.
Yeah, I love that.
You don't necessarily love it, but he's had a lot of time to get back and recover. For David Dvorak, I've seen him in the States because his Instagram pops up, because apparently I'm looking at David Dvorak's Instagram a lot, but it pops up quite a bit. And I saw him at the Canelo and Billy Joe Saunders fight. And he has a teammate in Jan Marsalek who competed on that card. Unfortunately, didn't get the win. He fought a 1-0 fighter. Lost that one on points. Yes. It happens, but you saw him over there taking pictures with Tyson Fury. You've seen him training in the States getting ready for this one. Recently, I absolutely love the fight. And it's tough not to gush about a guy that you were on before he came to the UFC. But I can see how this fight's very, very well matched. As far as the odds are concerned, they're fairly close. Dvorak opened a minus 150. The line dropped. It went back up again. Basically where it was. So minus 150 for Paiva. Same deal in reverse. He's about a plus 130. If you have a look at the Tapology votes, not even close at all. 1,021 of them, 87% Dvorak, 85% by decision. For the 13% that have Paiva, 69% by decision. Matt, I really like the well-rounded game out of David Dvorak. I know Zhalgas Shumagulov is one of those guys that he gets you down, and then he tries to keep position, but sometimes he loses it. David Dvorak's one of those guys that if he gets your back, you're in trouble. If he takes you down, you're in trouble. In the striking, Paiva can cause him issues. Paiva can knock him out. Who knows? I mean, David Dvorak hasn't lost a fight since 2012, and he's won, what, 15 in a row? And overall, out of his 19 wins, 15 are by finish. But I really like David Dvorak in this fight.
I like David Dvorak quite a bit, but I do think this is going to be a really exciting fight down at the flyweight division. Because for Dvorak, like you had said, he brings such a nice, well-rounded game to the mix. And he is dangerous anyways. And for Paiva, yes, I'm comfortable with him on the feet. But like you had said, I think Paiva can win exchanges on the feet. I know Dvorak's probably going to win on the mat if he gets there. I know he's the better wrestler. And I think in the striking exchanges, he can at least make it competitive enough to where when he does decide to mix in his wrestling and his jiu-jitsu, it will be keeping Paiva on the back foot. So no, I do agree. I think David Dvorak's got this one.
Both of us going with Czech Republic's David Dvorak to get the win. Absolutely love the fights coming up this weekend. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Straight up, this is the hardest fight on the card for me to get a read on. We've got Canada's Felicia Spencer, the Phenom, the former Invicta champ, taking on the immortal Matt Brown. No, it's Norma Dumont. And for Norma Dumont,
She weighed 139.5 pounds for her last win. She fought Ashley Evans-Smith. She pieced her up. She looked amazing. I think we had Evans-Smith in that one. But to me, and Matt, we talk about it, fighters need to level up. For Norma Dumont, coming into the UFC, what was she, 4-0? Taking on Megan Anderson at 145? Ugh. And she had a lot of time off. Big layoff. Long layoff. Got hit by that right cross. Got finished. Kind of gross. So then she moves down to 135. And you think, well, what do I have here? Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu brown belt. She's got a background in Sanda. You like to see that. Kind of neat. Not a discipline you hear about every single day in high-level MMA. And Norma Dumont looked great in her last fight. But again, weighed 139.5, so you got to rein it in a little bit. She was supposed to take on a very short-notice replacement in her last fight this spring in Erin Blanchfield. Blanchfield came in. Blanchfield made weight. She's a flyweight, but she moved up to bantamweight. You get the drift. And Norma Dumont again weighed in 139.5. Now, I talked about it in the video, how the weight cut was a bit of an issue, but the pictures on Instagram look great, so I'm not that worried. Apparently, I had to kind of be a little skeptical there and a little bit worried about the fight. So, Dumont now moving back up to 145, taking on Felicia Spencer, former Invicta champ. Very good grappler. You saw that in her fight against Megan Anderson. And if you want to play MMA math, which is the dumbest math to play, Spencer beat Anderson, Anderson beat Dumont, Spencer beats Dumont, but it's not really that way.
I mean, I think it kind of will be that way. Here's the weird thing for Norma Dumont. I don't know what she looks like against the top level of competition, because really, you lose to Megan Anderson. She's kind of like, remember when Mario Hezonja dunked on like Giannis and the Knicks showed that over and over and over again? Norma Dumont's kind of like Megan Anderson's like one highlight, where they were just scrapped. They're like, okay, what can we show positive for Megan Anderson before the Nunes fight? And they just kept on showing that right hand over and over and over. And that's really the only performance I can go off to judge how Norma Dumont's going to look in this fight, because this is her only other fight at the featherweight division. And this is a really tough ask, because I know Felicia Spencer can at least be competitive with really good fighters in this division. I know she's lost to Cyborg. I know she lost to Amanda Nunes. But the Cyborg fight was a really good fight that was back and forth. I'm not going to advocate she even won rounds in that fight, but she had moments. And she did cut open Cyborg with a Superman elbow, so that's going to be worth something. And then, yes, she gets outclassed by Amanda Nunes, but at least you must have good cardio if you're going that long with someone like Amanda Nunes. And yes, Felicia Spencer got outclassed on the feet, but again, I think not getting finished by Amanda Nunes deserves a medal in the UFC at this point.
Well, that's why they gave her the belt for the picture.
Yeah, exactly. They did give her, that's true. They gave her the belt, and I don't know if Nunes had had her daughter yet, so maybe Spencer could have held her, but still, she did get thoroughly outclassed in that matchup, and I do think that that fight is clouding people's judgment going into this fight, because at the end of the day, I don't think Norma Dumont does anything better than Felicia Spencer, and I definitely don't think she does anything better up at 145 pounds. I've seen Felicia Spencer run through Invicta, run through the only other really decent fighter at 145 in the UFC, and then lose to two all-time greats. So right now, I know Felicia Spencer is like, you're better than an all-star, but you're worse than an MVP. You're just kind of stuck in this middle tier by yourself. And it does suck for Spencer, because she's the only fighter in this division who doesn't have a belt around her waist. But I don't see anyone beating her at 145 other than Amanda Nunes.
Well, she was supposed to take on the former boxing champ. That's the other thing. I mean, Norma Dumont coming in on short notice for this one. It was supposed to be Danielle Wolfe.
Who?
You know, 1-0. That won on Contender Series in her pro debut. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Now, people didn't like you singing that a few weeks last week, but I'm going to do it right here because we're Canadian. But I look at this fight, Matt, and for Felicia Spencer, I have a hard time. She beat Sarah Farren. Sarah Farren, good boxer, also couldn't make 135 when she tried recently. Zero takedown defense, zero in terms of offering up any resistance on the ground. Spencer looked good. Spencer looked great against Megan Anderson. It's really tough to get an overall look at this one. If you're looking to place a bet on this, I shake my head at you, and you probably shouldn't. If you really do look into it a little bit more in terms of the odds, maybe it comes as a little bit of a surprise. I mean, Felicia Spencer opened up a minus 350 favorite. She's minus 163 right now.
I disagree with you on don't put... I gotta be honest, I like Felicia Spencer quite a bit in this matchup. We don't do locks or anything like that, but again, Norma Dumont has been able to get outstruck by fighters who I think are decent. This fight really comes down to, do you think Norma Dumont can outstrike Felicia Spencer? And do you think Norma Dumont can defend the takedowns of Felicia Spencer? Because I certainly don't. I think Felicia Spencer's the much better wrestler out of these two, and that's what this fight's going to come down to. Can Norma Dumont submit her off her back? Well, probably not. It's really, really hard to get submissions off of your back, especially against top-level grapplers like Felicia Spencer. So I honestly honestly don't even understand why the odds have adjusted themselves to become this close. Were they open when she was like a minus 350? I'm kind of surprised the odds still aren't there. I'm not saying better all the way until there. I'm not Yanni the Greek or anything. I'm just surprised the odds are as close as they are.
1,000 votes on Tapology, 91% Spencer, 53% by submission. It's the wrestling of Spencer, it's the striking of Dumont. And from what I saw out of the striking of Dumont in her last fight, she looked great. She really did look good against Ashley Evans-Smith. Like, it was a good performance. So I do have hesitation on this one. Again, I do see why the odds are where they're at right now. So I do disagree with you. I agree with the pick, but again, yeah, that's a tricky one. Like, you got two fighters.
Felicia Spencer was the Invicta champ at 145. Norma Dumont is doing this on short notice, guys. Felicia Spencer's so much bigger. She's the better wrestler. Again, I don't understand why there's any argument to this.
I mean, Dumont's tall. We're both going with Felicia Spencer, but you do you in this one. It is an interesting fight that we have on this card. Matt, our main event, Rob Font taking on Cody Garbrandt. Can't wait for it. Let's keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. A couple of big guys are going to throw leather this weekend in the octagon. We have the bad man, Justin Taffa, taking on the Mountain, not the guy from the Game of Thrones. It's Jared Vandera coming out of California, Team Quest. And listen, Matt, for Jared Vandera, he's a guy that's been on people's radars for a while. He competed with EFC. He had the fight on Contender Series to make it to the dance. He got the big win over Harry Hunsucker, who Tai Tuivasa dusted. And then he took on Sergey Spivak. And in that fight, listen, they clinched. Spivak beat him in the first round. Vandera gets up. And it was weird because they iso-cammed him. They didn't even focus on Spivak's corner. They just followed Jared Vandera into his. And he walks over, they give him the water, and just before he takes a sip of water, he says something. And then Bisping kind of plays telephone with it when the second round starts. He just kind of said, "I'm off right now." And yeah, he kind of looked a little off. I mean, he tried to wrestle, but Spivak is a great wrestler grappler. And he's a pretty good striker. He's one of those, you know, I don't think he's going to be top 10, but he'll be around
for a
while.
He's a poor man's Marcin Deborah.
He has some fun fights. And for Jared Vandera, well, he just got out-Spivak'd in that fight. Spivak, it was kind of a War-Tione fight by the end of it because he just kept hitting him and hitting him. The commentary team wanted to finish. Me at home wanted to finish. Me watching this fight this afternoon wanted to finish. And then finally, Tione finished it. So for Jared Vandera, we've seen it. He has a wrestling background, high school, a little bit here and there. He's a decent striker. He throws with some power. Not a whole heck of a lot of head movement. Don't really know where the cardio's at. But he has 16 pro fights. He's taking on a guy that has 6 pro fights in Justin Taffa. Now listen, Matt. Half of those fights are in the UFC. 2 of those fights were on pay-per-views to start his career. He's 3-0 and fought at a packed Marvel Stadium and got absolutely floored by Jorgen De Castro. Then he went out and fought Juan Adams, who was at home, and finished him.
Just keep going.
And then he had his last fight against Carlos Felipe, which is one of your favorite fights of all time.
I like watching Carlos Felipe fight. What can I say?
It was a great fight. They decided we're boxers now. We're going to press our foreheads together and start to land a combination. But for Justin Taffa, brother Junior, spent some time with Glory. He's got that kickboxing acumen. We've seen decent guys in the IG pictures. Tuivasa a little bit. We've seen Mark Hunt as well. But Justin Taffa, a striker. Jared Vandera, striker wrestler. This is a fight that I'm halfway surprised is on the main card, because if you don't get a finish, it's going to be a tricky.
So I was going to lead with, why is this fight on the main card, Craig? Because it baffles me, but we can get to that some other time.
Look at this. Just a second. They made you pay to watch the fight against Jorgen De Castro. They made you pay to watch him fight Juan Adams. He finishes Juan Adams, then they put him on the prelims of a fight night. It's weird.
And I tweeted at Dana White, like, make sure Justin Taffa gets my share of the pay-per-view tonight. It's weird, because for Taffa, listen, we can talk about his striking and his kickboxing. I've seen him get outstruck too many times for me to be all that confident in his stand-up. Because, listen, Jorgen De Castro is an undersized heavyweight who has decent hand speed, but listen, he closed his eyes and threw an overhand right that landed on Justin Taffa and knocked him out. It's not like he set up the knockout shot or anything. Go back and watch the tape. I wish we had access to the tape and we could show it right now. But still, just believe me, Justin Taffa walks forward, Jorgen De Castro, eyes shut, throws. You're not Steph Curry after shooting the ball. You can't turn around. That's basically what Justin Taffa did. I watched Justin Taffa walk into an overhand right. It's tough for me to be all that confident in a guy who is classified as a striker when I've seen you make striking mistakes like that. And even Carlos Felipe, who, listen,
he's a good striker and he's a good boxer.
But Carlos Felipe's not a terrible fighter by any means. But, like, the fact that you were getting heavily outstruck and out-volume struck by Carlos Felipe...
Split decision.
In a fight that you got outstruck in for the most part, it's just Justin Taffa, you could only be billed as a kickboxer for so many times until I'm going to have to see you out-kickbox guys in the UFC. And yes, beating Juan Adams is decent, but there's a reason Juan Adams is no longer in the UFC. He's not really of that level. I think we're going to learn a lot about both these guys because of this fight. Because honestly, Jared Bandera hasn't really given UFC fans a lot to get excited for. Yes, the win over Harry Hunsaker, it means something, but it's not like that. It means that you're ready for like top 15 guys. And for Justin Taffa, I think that there's a base there. I do think that there's a foundation for a decent fighter at the heavyweight division. But my issue is that when I see you get outboxed by Carlos Felipe, and it's not like he knocked you out, he overwhelmed you with his volume. Well, that's not how Jorge de Castro outstruck you. He overwhelmed you with his power. So I've seen you struggle with power, and I've seen you struggle with volume. It gets to be a certain point where if I'm looking at Justin Taffa, how does he win a fight on the feet? I know he can invest in the leg kicks. I know he has good power himself. But even if you go back and watch Justin Taffa's fights on the regional scene in Australia, this is a guy who gets out-grappled by guys who have 0-1 records in MMA, who never fought after they fought Justin Taffa. Taffa's amateur, not amateur record, but his regional record is a little bit shoddy, and the fact that his only good performance that I've seen is against Juan Adams makes me really hesitant. And yes, Jared Bandera is a guy who he stands upright. He is hittable. But even if you're upright and hittable, I still think you could have some success against Justin Taffa on the feet.
So for Jared Bandera, typically holds his hands right here, but keeps his head on the center line, doesn't really move it. So he can get hit by hooks, he can get hit by straight shots, he can also get hit to the body, doesn't really cover up all that well there. And if you watch his fight against Harry Hunsaker, that's what happened. Like, Hunsaker put it on him. And listen, we were pretty difficult on Harry Hunsaker before his fight, coming into the UFC on short notice against Tuivasa. But what's Hunsaker good at? Blitzing, hitting with power shots, getting on top, and finishing fights. And that's what Hunsucker's good at. He almost did that against Bandera, who then came back and beat Hunsaker. You look at the other loss in his last five fights to Henan Fahea. I bet you the UFC wishes they had Henan. PFL, don't overturn that win. He only tapped twice, didn't tap a third time. But for Henan Fahea, he is a good fighter. A loss like that, eh, we'll let it slide a little bit. But with Jared Bandera, he's more that old school heavyweight. And when I watch his fights, I think like...
Tim Sylvia?
Well, he's not Brock Lesnar, because Brock was a really powerful wrestler and had really heavy hands. He's kind of like Brock's buddy, Chris Tuchscher. You know, Chris made it pretty far, but not far enough. He had power, he had wrestling, but when he really got against the top level guy, it just didn't work out all that well. Chris Tuchscher, or Josh Parisian, if you want a local comp, a recent comp.
Jack May.
But the weird thing about, well, Jack May, too. If you want a Jared Bandera thing, listen, he has the height advantage, he has the length advantage, he has the leg reach advantage. And this is the thing that I really took away when we were previewing Jared Bandera's last fight against Spivak. He said in an interview with Justin Sampnelli, or Sampnetti rather, he wanted to beat Justin Gaethje's leg kick record in the UFC. And we've seen it in his fights where he has really, really heavy thunderous leg kicks. I don't think they're going to work all that great against Taffa. But in a fight like this, it almost seems like a bit of a crapshoot of a pick, so I have a really hard time on it.
This is the definition of Taffa wins in the first minute, or we're going to get an awful fight for about 15 more minutes, and then Bandera will win a decision. I don't see this fight being all that exciting, and I know we like to start this with, really excited for this matchup, not really excited for this matchup. This is the pop and popcorn, like, hey, I'm going to run to the store fight of the main card, but... I do think Bandera's wrestling is going to be able to beat Justin Taffa. I don't discredit the fact that, yes, Jared Bandera does stand very upright. He doesn't have a lot of head movement. But I do think if he can get past that first little rush of Justin Taffa, I do think he'll be able to win the fight. This isn't me saying Jared Bandera is going to go on and be in the top 15 anytime soon. I just don't really think either guy is going to go on and have this long, illustrious career in the heavyweights. I just think Jared Bandera is going to be the better fighter come Saturday.
I have the hardest time on this one because one guy has 16 pro fights. The other guy is 6. Taffa's a good striker. I do like what he brings to the table, but if Bandera is able to take him out and just kind of wear on him, what Juan Adams maybe should have done or could have done. But even with Juan Adams, and I gotta say it, he had switched camps. He was doing like the long pawing reach thing, which Jackson Wink tried to also do with Maurice Green. It didn't work for him either. Like the heavyweights, I mean, who knows what's gonna happen with John Jones there. But yeah, I do ever so slightly side with Bandera, and I look at the topology votes, and I'm way off the map, apparently, because 1,048 total votes, 83% Taffa, 87% by knockout, the 17% that have Bandera, 62% by knockout. Like, yeah, I can definitely see a world where Taffa knocks him out. I will go with the advantage in terms of, listen, overall MMA fights, and the wrestling advantage that Vandera has. But if Taffa knocks him out in the first round, I wouldn't be surprised by that either. I'm split on it. Pop and popcorn fight. I think I've covered all my bases there, but yeah, I'm going with Vandera.
Yeah, at the end of the day, this isn't a glamour fight for the heavyweight division by any means, but no, I do agree with you. I have Vandera.
Matt, both of us reluctantly going with Jared Vandera to get the win, going with the Mountain. Big fights coming up. We got our co-main event, Yan Xiaonan, and taking on Carlos Spires at the top of the strawweight division. In the main event, Rob Font, Cody Garbrandt. Keep locked in with Fight Name Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Breaking news, this important PSA is brought to you by Manscaped. This is your... They spelled it. Pubic service announcement and the news you've all been waiting for. The Manscaped engineering team has confirmed that they have successfully created the lawnmower, not one, not two, not three, but 4.0 trimmer, which is now available for purchase in the USA and Canada. Matt, ours is in the mail, so I can only tell you what they've told me. But really, join over 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer for you. Get 20% off and free shipping with promo code FNP at manscaped.com. Now, Matt, they've had great products before. I can tell you about the ceramic blade technology on the 3.0. I have it in the shed, which is the bag of goodies you're going to get if you order the perfect package with them. But the big highlight that I got from the 3.0 was the LED light. And I say this every week, and I still am saying it. I still haven't charged this puppy.
Which is really impressive, honestly. And here's the other really impressive thing. I've never once had my 3.0 and thought, hey, how can they make this even better? Now, I do understand we're waiting for the 4.0 in the mail, but goodness, if you can improve upon the 3.0 in any way whatsoever, you know Manscaped's doing the right thing.
It is a difficult thing to improve on, but so they say, they have done it. And I can't wait to get it in my hands. Now, when you go with the new trimmer, the things that they have, new multifunction on-off switch, you can engage a travel lock. And I've been there before where I wheel up into a hotel room. You pull your bag out and you go, I'm in a different city. Where do I buy batteries? Because my trimmer is on. And I had those discount trimmers that you, well, throw in your toiletry bag. And yeah, I've had issues like that. So that is one really neat thing. The 4.0 gives you the ability to turn on the 4000K LED spotlight on and off when you need it for a precise trim. We've all been in those dungeon bathrooms. And right there, bam, that light helps you on the 3.0. It's definitely great on the 4.0. You can now trim in four different guard lengths. And look-wise, it has a two-tone mat. It's pretty darn good looking. If you're going to take a picture, toss it onto the socials. But if you do go with their products, they also have great stuff like the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant. It's like a salve. You just toss that stuff on there. They also have the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. Throw that on there if you want a little bit of a spritz of a pick-me-up in the morning. And if you're over on their site, they also have the refined cologne. It's that great smell that you know and love from Manscaped. I know. I love it. And if you're over there and you're feeling cocky, you can pick up the Weed Whacker. Big nose hair guy in terms of I have it, and it's a problem. And I use this sucker all the time. It has been charged because I use it all the time. And apparently my weeds are out of control. But check them out, manscaped.com. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. We can't thank them enough, and we really do appreciate the support with the channel. So get 20% off and free shipping with code FNP at manscaped.com. It's 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with promo code FNP. Unlock your confidence and always use the right tools to do the job with Manscaped. Matt, as we always say with Fight Night Picks, let's get into it. Really interesting fight coming up this weekend. Top five women's strawweights in our co-main event. Yan Xiaonan taking on Carla Esparza. And Matt, is it future champ against former champ? That's probably how this is going to be billed. Because for Yan Xiaonan, listen, friend of the show, Drake Riggs, we got to shout him out here now. He has been on the train for some time. And for her, she's been amazing in the UFC. If you look at the five on in, a win over Viviane Pereira, you got to have those wins. That was 2 years, 10 months ago. Beats Siri Kondo, that's good. Beats Angela Hill, beats Karolina Kovalkiewicz, beats Claudia Gadelha. Those are some names near the end. For Carla Esparza, she was one of those fighters where, again, almost 3 years ago, loses to Tatiana Suarez, who we haven't seen in some time. Beats Vina Jandidoba, beats Alexa Grasso, beats Michelle Waterson, beats Marina Rodriguez. Listen, Waterson-Rodriguez, great fight we had recently. Rodriguez, future title challenger, maybe. But Carla Spires has been there and done that. And this was a fighter where 3 or 4 years ago, you and I were either talking into a mic or sitting there drinking pops, watching the fights, going, geez, Well, she gets better at something every time. Like, you had to kind of grasp at straws at what Carla Esparza was doing well, because it was almost like the Randa Markos plan of you win when you lose one. Like, where is Carla at this point? And now all of a sudden, legit title contender, like top five fighter in a huge fight against Yan Xiaonan. So I'm really eager to get your thoughts on this one. You got Yan Xiaonan, who's trained a little bit getting ready for this one at Team Alpha Male. Carla Esparza has been a Team Oyama fighter for quite some time. I love this matchup.
This is a really fun fight at the strawweight division. For Yan Xiaonan, she's kind of on one of those like Kelvin Gastelum legends runs at strawweight. Because look at the names you brought up. Angela Hill, former Invicta champion. Karolina Kovalkiewicz. I know she's still kind of in and around the MMA world, but still, I would say a one-time great strawweight. And Claudia Gadelha, again, one of the original OGs of this weight division. If Yan Xiaonan could go out there and then beat Carla Esparza, you've basically beaten all of the great fighters who came before you, other than Joanna Jędrzejczyk at that point. And yes, she still has the Rose Namajunas, the Weilis, and if Jessica Andrade ever comes back, but like, you've done a lot of the heavy lifting already. If we do think Yan Xiaonan is eventually going to become champ, you've already beaten those fighters who have kind of laid the foundation just really for the whole weight class. It's just been a really impressive run that Yan Xiaonan's been able to go on. And it's not like she's going out there and just beating other fighters. She's not going out there beating Mackenzie Dern, like another fellow rising star. It has been the fact that she's going out there and beating fighters who kind of all have bigger names than she has. And then it's after the fight, it's like, wow. Remember when she just did Angela Hill? And then, wow, remember when she just did Claudia Gadelha? And the thing I like about Yan Xiaonan is she is just so well-rounded at the end of the day. Because when I think about Claudia, yeah, her striking's kind of bad, but her ground game's amazing. With Karolina, it's kind of the opposite. She's a great striker, but her ground game's not great. And then with Angela Hill, just kind of good at everything. Yan Xiaonan was able to go in there and not only beat all those fighters at where they're the strongest, she was able to really reverse it and force them to become uncomfortable at the areas that they aren't good at. And that's what's really impressive about Yan Xiaonan. Normally, we don't speak about those qualities in a fighter until they have the belt or they've been fighting top five fighters for a very long time. But the fact that we saw all these qualities from her, even on her way up into the rankings, is really exciting. And the fact that finally we get Yan Xiaonan against, I'll say, still one of those legends, but I would say Carla Esparza has a lot more tread left on the tires than maybe some of those other legends that she has in kind of her wake. So that's what makes this fight really fun. Can the former champion kind of keep her place in the division and say, hey, I might be the former champion, but I could still be future champion? Or can Yan Xiaonan say, like, hey, there's more than one Chinese fighter in this division, and I can go out there and really prove that I'm not like Wei Li. I can be the next evolution. And that's why this fun fight is just so exciting.
And I mean, you look at it in terms of numbers, metrics, holy smokes. I mean, for Yan Xiaonan, the strikes landed per minute, huge differential in the positive. For Carla, it's a slight negative. You also like to see the takedown defense from Yan Xiaonan, 75%, 75% accuracy. You think the move to Team Alpha Male probably going to help out with that a little bit. But again, we've seen these impressive performances from Yan Xiaonan. From Carla Esparza, they've always been close, and that's the thing. The Marina Rodriguez fight, you win by split. You beat Watterson by split. You beat Alexa Grasso by majority decision. You beat Vina Jandidoba. That's cool. I think back to her fight against Claudia Gadelha, the one that was in, where was it, Chicago? That was back at UFC 225, where the fans booed because they thought that Carla won. I thought she won. Claudia got it. She beat Cynthia Calvillo before that. She beat the...
That was 4 years ago, though.
Oh, yeah. Now we're starting to grasp it. She beat the great volume striker, Marina Moroz, before that. But that's the thing. Carla Esparza, been there and done that in the division. She's continued to progress. I like her game, but the tricky thing is she's one of those fighters that's going to almost strike to clinch, clinch to take you down, work from full guard, maybe go to side. Then she's going to try and land some stuff. Like, it's just really tricky for me to see a path to victory for Carla Esparza to beat Yan Xiaonan. It is tough.
Well, the path to victory is going to have to be a wrestling. And it's something against Carla Esparza. Like you had said, she has definitely improved even after she lost the belt. But she's not improving as like, oh wow, now Carla Esparza works behind the jab and throws kicks. She's just kind of become more Carla Esparza-y as her career's progressed. She's gotten better at some of the weird little areas, kind of the in-betweens, if you will. She has gotten a lot better, like you said, at striking into the clinch. But it's not like her striking itself has improved that much. And that's what I worry about with Carla Esparza. All of her wins, at least all of her recent wins, they still come by way of that wrestling. And the one thing that sucks for Carla Esparza, and this is unfair, and this is something that I put on her, I can't get that excited about Carla Esparza going to fight for the title when I know there's a better version of Carla Esparza who's only sidelined due to injury right now. Tatiana Suarez does everything Carla Esparza does. She just does it way better. And it's not like this is some hot take for me. I saw those two fight, and Tatiana Suarez did everything to Carla Esparza does to other people, but to herself.
And the other thing about Esparza is when she takes you down, she finishes you. She has ground and pound, she has chokes. Carla Esparza is more of that, oh, I'll take you down, I'll kind of lay in some positions. I'll get work done, don't get me wrong. It's not like the refs are standing her up a lot. But she's not going out there really searching for the finish. And in this fight against Yan Xiaonan, if it's on the feet, I'm a little worried about Carla. She does have very rudimentary striking. And unless she is able to just rush in with those flurries to try to clinch her way into a takedown, I just don't see her winning a lot of moments on the feet. And if you looked at Carla Esparza's recent few opponents, Marina Rodriguez wasn't really able to unload her strikes because she was worried about the takedown. And when she did let her hands go, she was landing a lot. Really, all of the opponents of Carla Esparza have been able to land on her. The only question has come down to their own takedown defense. But with Yan Xiaonan, I think her movement on the feet and her takedown defense are going to be good enough to force this fight into a striking battle. And at the end of the day, it's really hard to say Carla Esparza is going to beat Yan in a 15-minute striking fight.
When we look at the odds for this one, Yan Xiaonan opened a minus 180 favorite. She's now minus 125. Carla Esparza opened a plus 155. She's around a plus 100, so those odds are closing in. If we have a look at the total Tapology votes, 1114 of them, 78% going with Yan Xiaonan to win, 92% by decision for the 22% that have Esparza, 86% by decision. So the safe pick, most likely the fight goes to decision, and I bet you that line, because we don't have it yet, is probably somewhere around a minus 300. It's going to be fairly heavily weighted that way. Let's actually look at it. Minus 333 on some sites, minus 325. So yeah, heavily favored to go to decision. I like Yan Xiaonan in this one. If you can stick and move, if you can work in your striking, your volume, your maybe not the kicks, and if you can defend enough of the initial takedowns, you're golden. So yeah, I do like Yan Xiaonan in this fight.
No, I couldn't agree more. With Carla Esparza, I still think there's a place for her in this division, and I do think she's a great litmus test for really any young contender that you have, I guess, title hopes for. But I do think Yan Xiaonan is going to be the fighter to get over this hump.
Matt, both of us going with Yan Xiaonan to get the win. Can't wait for our main event. Rob Font taking on Cody Garbrandt. So if you missed it, check it out. If you haven't watched it yet, check it out. Those are the same thing. So go check it out. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Big time main event coming up this weekend at Bantamweight. We have Rob Font taking on No Love Cody Garbrandt. Matt, one half of your hosting duo. You can find him on Twitter and Instagram at Matt Allen FNP. As always, myself, Craig Allen FNP over on the socials. Now, Matt, absolutely love this fight because it's an all-action type of pairing. You get the great boxing from Rob Font. You get a guy that has a win over the current Bellator bantamweight champ Sergio Pettis in a fight that wasn't all that competitive. I mean, Font, it was absolutely his night that night. And if you look at the five on in, only one loss to Rafael Assuncao almost 3 years ago. The win over Pettis, one over Ricky Simon. His last time out, he finished Marlon Moraes in a fight that wasn't all that competitive for Marlon at the end. I mean, Rob Font poured it on. It was a great win. New England Cartel on the map, if they weren't already, with Calvin Kattar and Joe Lauzon and Tyson Chariot and everybody else.
The boys.
But really, for Rob Font, he looked amazing in that performance. And for Cody Garbrandt, he had those three losses. He didn't look great in them so much. And then in his last time out against Rafael Assuncao, really good fight. And then at the end, I've never seen somebody go so full extension on a shot like that. It was Aaron Pico-esque. And it was disgusting. Garbrandt has that hype. But the trouble is, that fight was almost a year ago. 11 months and a week ago, he had COVID, long-haul symptoms. You hate to see it. Like, it's really unfortunate for an athlete like himself. I'm just glad we get this fight.
No, I couldn't agree more. This fight really is going to be a fun fight because it's been a while since we've had a fight like this. Now, we have had one other one this year, and I'll say it in a second. But Garbrandt and Rob Font might actually set a record for least amount of kicks thrown in a 25-round fight, or in a 25-minute fight, sorry, between two primary strikers, because neither guy is in love with the kicks, two primary boxers, and this fight really does remind me a lot of when Calvin Kattar fought Max Holloway earlier on in the year, because that was the conversation leading into that fight. Who is the better boxer? Is it the Calvin Kattar who has more of a boxing background, I guess, or is it Max Holloway, who in MMA primarily uses his hands? Now, we learned that night that Max Holloway might be the greatest striker ever, but I do think this fight is going to perform and deliver the same kind of fireworks that that one did. Because with Cody Garbrandt, I'm going to call this the Jimmy Manoa effect, but it probably should be known as the Cody Garbrandt effect. Because if Cody Garbrandt wins, it's probably by knockout. When Cody Garbrandt loses, it's also by knockout. He is one of those kill or be killed fighters. I know the story with Garbrandt always is the mentality. It's, oh, what is Cody Garbrandt feeling like fight week? It's, is he going to be that hothead who's going to go in there and just disregard his own chin and well-being looking for the knockout? And that's normally the version that gets knocked out. Or is it going to be the patient Garbrandt that we saw in the Sun Tzu fight? It's really hard to say. And I do feel like Garbrandt's one of those unique fighters who it really depends on what the buildup is to see what version of him we get in that fight. I do think he's one of those fighters who you can kind of rile him up before the fight and make him fight in an emotional way. Now, I say all of that, and he is one of those fighters you can take advantage of. Rob Font's not going to be the fighter who takes advantage of that X factor. I don't think Rob Font's ever talked crap in his life before. Like, Rob Font just seems like a real nice, regular dude for the most part.
I saw him one time in Bangor, Maine, at an auditorium, getting ready for a fight.
There you go, Rob Font, just like you and me. But no, I do think this fight's really fun. But the thing that you do have to ask yourself, I'm going to even ask you, how much weight can you put into that Moraes win? Because that was a Marlin who had just got wheel kicked by Corey Sandhagen like 3 weeks earlier. I know it was like 2 months, but still, it was him on a quick turnaround. Knowing what we know now about Marlin, he is a little bit chinny. It's just, with Rob Font, he is riding this crazy high after that Marlin win, and it was a beautiful knockout, don't get me wrong. I just feel like we're putting a lot of weight into a performance where we don't really know what version of the opponent he was locked in there with. Because with Marlin, yes, he does have great power, he's got great speed, but he's known as a bit of a glass cannon, and the fact that Rob Font was able to catch him early, and the fact that he was coming off a knockout loss so quick, maybe I'm diminishing the win too much, but it is something that concerns me.
It's a great win for Rob Font, and then you look at the other two. So I put a lot of weight in the Sergio Pettis fight, because before that, he had the fight with Benavidez, he had the fight with Cejudo, like, he fought some big names, still really young in his career. That was a weird thing that, like, the UFC even said, hey, still consider free agency. Yeah, go over to Bellator, have fun, see what happens. Great things happen, that's what happens. But you look at that win, that's a great win. You look at the one over Ricky Simone. I have a hard time with Ricky Simone. He's my Casey Kenny. Like, where are you really in this division? How good are you? Because I know he can wrestle. I know he can strike. He did that in his last fight against Brian Kelleher. Like, it's just really tough to tell what Simone you get. Font was on both of those nights. Font was really on against Moraes to the point where he finished him. Garbrandt was really on against the Sun Tzu. How's his gas tank going to be in this fight? Like, what's he really going to look like? I do have a really hard time trying to tell you how good Cody Garbrandt is. Like, again, depending on where you fall on the subject, like, one of my favorite pitchers for the Boston Red Sox, Eduardo Rodriguez, lost a whole season because of, the heart inflammation that he incurred due to COVID. So it's really tough to tell with all of these things. For Garbrandt, he's been off for such a long time. There was a rumored move to 125. He was going to fight Deiveson Figueiredo. It never happened. Like, Cody Garbrandt's had a weird calendar year. And now he's in a fight against a guy that fights fairly similar to him. I mean, for Garbrandt, again, use what got you to the dance. It's his boxing. You look at the fight against Thomas Almeida as a bit of a precursor for what was to come. But again, Augusto Mendes, great jiu-jitsu practitioner, finished him. Marcus Brimage in the debut, finished him. Beat Henry Briones. That's neat. Beat Takeya Mitsugaki. A little long in the tooth, but he finished him. Looked amazing against Dominic Cruz. It was that Gavin Tucker, Sam Cecilia type performance.
5 years
but
ago.
Really, Garbrandt was the one that did it. Lose to Dillashaw, lose to Dillashaw, lose to Pedro Munhoz. Now, he was able to rock Dillashaw, and then he got rocked, and then they had the rematch, which seemed kind of silly at the time, because you just beat Cruz, and you only had the one fight. Like, it was a little early. But anyway, they did it again. It was a fun fight. It was exciting while it lasted. And then Pedro Munhoz, they decided, hey, we're just going to be boxers and we're going to strike. We're going to rock each other. And then Munhoz ended up finishing him the same way that Dillashaw finished him. Kind of gross. Watch out for the right hand, right? Just look out for them. They're coming. Great fight against the Sun Tzu, who was long in the tooth. So now we're at this point where we have two great boxers. It's tough to tell what we're going to get out of Garbrandt. It's tough to put too much stock into some of the Font wins. But they're both right at the top of the division. It's a weird fight.
It is, and I'm really happy you brought that up, actually, because these are two guys that they're going to call contenders, or, oh, the winner of this get a title shot. No, I don't think they deserve it. For all those reasons that we brought up, like, I do think Cody Garbrandt, even if he knocks out Rob Font in the first round, like, you still need another win, I think, or maybe even two more, because the things that I think about when I think about Cody Garbrandt are him saying a bunch of dumb things on a microphone and him getting knocked out a lot. And when I look at the top of that division, It's still TJ Dillashaw. It's guys like Corey Sandhagen. It's guys like Piotr Jan who, like, you think you're good at striking. Well, Piotr Jan doesn't get hit clean ever, and when he touches people, they automatically drop to the ground.
Legally or illegally.
Legally or illegally. And Corey Sandhagen, I don't know if you've been following along, is also a very dynamic and well-rounded striker. So I just look at Rob Font and I look at Cody Garbrandt. Yes, you might be able to beat out kind of your polar opposite. Not your polar opposite, but you might be able to beat out yourself in this division. But both these guys still just bring the, I'm the best boxer in the division now. When you fight Corey Sandhagen, you better bring more than just hands. Because he is a guy, he's going to stand at such a range, he's going to kick you on the way in and make you punish when you do come in. Last thing on this fight. I really think this fight comes down to who lands first. This is one of the most heavyweight fights you'll ever see at bantamweight. And I don't say that because both guys have a ton of power, which they both do, but neither guy's the most durable in the world. Like, Rob Font might not have the knockout losses on his record, but even look back at the Rafael Assuncao fight. Like, Assuncao's not a power puncher by any means, and he dropped Rob Font in that fight. I've seen Rob Font get hit, and I've seen Rob Font get hit clean to the point where I worry about his durability a little bit, to the point where if a guy like Cody Garbrandt hits you, then you're definitely going to hit the ground. Think of Michael Chandler, for instance. Michael Chandler's the guy who, oddly enough, we've had a decent read on his UFC career, so we can pat ourselves on the back a little bit. But yes, his power might be a 10 out of 10, to where if he hits you once, you're going to go down. But the fact that his chin isn't on that level means that anyone can also knock him out. Cody Garbrandt's that same fighter. If he lands on you, you are going to go down. I don't care how old he is, how young he is, or what stage of his career Cody Garbrandt's at. He still has crazy hand speed for this division and God-given power. But with Rob Font, he's got those long-range techniques that can catch Garbrandt on the way in. So my last question, or I guess this is how I'll hand it over. Do you think Cody Garbrandt can get on the inside of Rob Font, or is Rob Font going to knock him out before he gets there?
6-inch reach advantage for Rob Font. Like, it's significant, and if you want to go numbers, I mean, Rob Font, huge strike advantage in terms of the differential at about a plus 1.5 or thereabouts for Cody Garbrandt. 0.02. And listen, a strike defense, 65% in the UFC, that's great. Again, consider level of competition, but also Cruz and Dillashaw and Munoz. And again, for the takedowns, Cody Garbrandt, they were feeding that fed horse in the build-up to his title fights. Listen, I've got that high school wrestling pedigree.
They act like he's Kamaru Usman.
I can stop all these takedowns. He does have 100% takedown defense. I don't see Rob Font going for takedowns in this fight. They're probably going to slug it out on the feet. If Garbrandt is the patient reserve Garbrandt, maybe he wins. If Rob Font's able to kind of use those prodding techniques that he's been known for, Rob Font wins. Hand speed's going to play a factor into this one. So if we do have a look at the odds, they're close. You knew they were going to be close. Font open to minus 125. He's minus 112. Garbrandt open to plus 105. He's minus 110. So it's basically a pick 'em fight. In terms of the Tapology votes, 1,134.
Wow.
58% Font, 85% have him to win by knockout. 42% Garbrandt, 79% have him to win by knockout. Probably not going to go to a judge's scorecard. And if you're playing along at home and you want to know what the odds are for that, fight doesn't go to a decision, minus 275, minus 260. So if you want to go with that, go with that. I think, yeah, we're probably going to get a finish in this one. Both guys have great hand speed, so I didn't really answer your question, but what is your pick here?
This is such a volatile fight, because again, at the end of the day, do I think Garbrandt can evade some of those prodding shots of Rob Font to the point where he gets in close, so close, that Rob Font can't use advantage of his big hooks or his straight punches? The thing that Rob Font doesn't have, like, this is why I think Brian Ortega is such a great fighter. Brian Ortega said, I am like God level at jiu-jitsu. I don't really need to get that much better at jiu-jitsu. So what if I figured out ways to either get guys onto the ground, or I figure out other ways to kind of accentuate the rest of my game. So Brian Ortega thought, okay, I'm good at boxing, but when guys get close to me, I struggle. That's when he started incorporating a lot of elbows. So you see Brian Ortega throwing spinning elbows, elbows in the clinch. If Rob Font had those weapons, I'd be so much more confident with him in this fight. Because again, for Garbrandt to have success, he's going to have to close that space at some point. And I worry about Garbrandt's ability to take a shot while he does close that distance. So for me, I do have to pick Rob Font, and most likely by stoppage. I just worry about not only the chin of Cody Garbrandt, but just his decision-making in the cage, especially if he does get cracked once and he does kind of see red and he's like, oh, I got to get that back. That's what they always said about kind of like the shoot-to-box guys. Like, that's why Verdum got knocked out by Stipe. He gets hit by that one good shot and he's like, oh, I got to get him back. And that's why he rushes forward. I'm not saying Cody Garbrandt's going to run straight into a straight right, but he is one of those fighters who, if you can rock him and kind of test him in that way, he's going to want to go right back at you and get that one back. And I think that's when you walk into a big counter shot from Rob Font.
And we saw that happen three times in a row where he just saw red and just had to go for it and ultimately paid the price of getting finished in those fights. But I think back to Cody Garbrandt, and I think of the footwork, and I think of the head movement, and I think of the things that got him to the dance. And if he can incorporate those, he had the time off. He had even more time off. Again, who knows how long he was training. Again, feeding a fed horse. I was so concerned about John McDessie having so much time off and the knee injury when he fought Ignacio Bahamondes. It really just played with my brain. But I look at a fight like this. I love those things from Cody Garbrandt that got him here. He was able to incorporate them somewhat into the fight with the Sun Tzu. He also had the kind of flow like almost I have, but mine's frozen in place. And the full beard. If he comes in with that against a guy like Rob Font. Oh my. So I am ever so slightly going with Garbrandt, not for the beard and the hair factor, and again, the bandana. Ooh. I mean, when you bring those things in, yikes. But I do like the speed. I do like the footwork. Both guys, yeah, Rob Font hasn't been finished as recently as Cody Garbrandt has. But again, I do like all of the things out of Garbrandt in a fight like this. It's so volatile. So if it was me on a weekend, on a question mark kicks, fight doesn't go the distance, minus 265. I like that more. But listen, I won't be that guy. Good. It's my show. I can do whatever I want. I will go with Garbrandt in this fight, ever so slightly.
I have to say one last thing. Cody Garbrandt should never move down to 125. I don't know why that was a conversation. I don't know who started that conversation. I'm telling you right now, Deviston Figueiredo definitely knocks him out at 125 pounds. Because I'm curious about his durability at 135. I don't think he'd be that durable at 125, and I'm pretty sure Deviston Figueiredo hits extremely hard for that weight class. I just don't want that to be a conversation after this fight. I'd hate to see Cody Garbrandt win a big fight against Rob Font, have the opportunity to really boost himself up in the bantamweight rankings, and then be like, hey, I'd love to move down to 125 and attempt to do what TJ Dillashaw did. It would kind of leave a sour taste in my mouth. Yeah, let's just not make that a conversation moving forward. There's a lot of fun fights for Garbrandt to have at 135. 135 is low-key one of the best divisions in the UFC anyway, so why would you want to subtract Cody Garbrandt from it? But yeah, couldn't be more excited for this main event, although I have fought, you have Garbrandt.
Matt, absolutely love the fight. We differ on the pick. Make sure you check out Question Mark Kicks this Saturday, 2 hours before the prelims. All sorts of great fights. Fingers crossed, none of them fall out. But we're loving this card. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in these matchups, as well as your possible fight of the night. Matt, we love the card. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.